You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome back to Talk Nation Radio our friend Harvey Wasserman. He is, of course, a lifelong activist who speaks and writes and organizes on energy and the environment and history and the drug war and election protection and grassroots politics. He has been teaching since 2004 history and cultural and ethnic diversity at two colleges in central Ohio. He works for the permanent shutdown of the nuclear power industry and the birth of Solartopia, and you should get his book on Solartopia if you have not already, and check out solartopia.org. He writes for EcoWatch and FreePress.org and NukeFree.org, which he edits. He helped to found the Anti-War Liberation News Service in 1972. His History of the United States, which you should also read, introduced by Howard Zinn, helped to pave the way for a new generation of people's histories. In 1973, Harvey Wasserman coined the phrase "no nukes" and helped found the global grassroots movement against atomic energy. In 1990, he became a senior advisor to Greenpeace. Harvey's America at the Brink of Rebirth, The Organic Spiral of U.S. History, will be published soon at solartopia.org. Harvey Wasserman, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Hey, it's great to be with you, David.
It's great to have you on here, and I want to talk about several topics, if you've got 28 minutes, and we can fit them in. And one is that you are going to be speaking, for which we are very grateful, at a conference coming up in September that we've organized at World Beyond War, and people can check it out at worldbeyondwar.org and sign up to come to the conference in Washington, D.C., or to others around the world, or to plan one of their own in their area. But you will be in Washington, D.C., and speaking about connections between the environment and war and peace. Can you give us a little taste of a preview?
Well, first of all, I'm honored to be invited, and I'm going to be talking in specifically in terms of two major issues. First, the energy situation. We're in the process, David, of shutting down the global atomic energy industry. I'm very, very happy to be able to say that, actually. But we've had four commercial reactors announcements shut within the recent days, and we expect many more because the entire nuclear fleet of commercial reactors, not only in the United States, but all over the world, has become profoundly uneconomic. It always was, but the industry was able to hide its losses within the governmental bailouts, and they've found that now politically virtually impossible to do without massive public uproar. And as a result, they're having to face the actual market, which unfortunately, because of fracked gas, but thankfully because of renewable energy, the two of them have really priced out atomic power. And so all over the country, and really all over the world, it's happening in Europe as well. We don't know exactly what's happening in China, but we suspect that's happening there. It's happening there as well. So all over the world, around 400 commercial reactors that have been built are being phased out, and we don't see really much prospect for new reactors being built because there's tremendous public resistance and tremendous market resistance. So this is the first thing I'm going to say. In conjunction with that, as you mentioned, Solartopia, we are seeing the simultaneous rise, and of course it's a cause of this, of a huge revolution, as Bernie would say, a huge revolution in renewable energy. The cost of solar, of wind, of other green technologies, Solartopian technologies, has just plummeted as their efficiencies have risen to the point where we really can envision a rapid transition to the whole world being put onto a energy generation system that is in concert and in harmony with the planet as opposed to at war with it. Rooftop solar in particular, I believe photovoltaic cells will be the biggest industry in the history of the world after the Internet. And, of course, it's related to the Internet. And this transition to an energy economy based on renewables, based on the bounties of the Earth as opposed to being at war with the Earth, will have an enormous impact. We just have to hope we get there before the next Fukushima. I mean, the arc of nuclear disasters has been terrifying. If you trace it from Three Mile Island to Chernobyl to Fukushima, we can only shudder at what might come next. So while we talk joyously about this transition to Solartopia and to a green-powered Earth, we are in terror of what is happening to the commercial reactors, which are really going down very rapidly in terms of their safety, in terms of the quality of maintenance and operation that's involved. They're running out of spare parts. They're running out of people who can actually operate them as the nuclear operating fleet of humans gets older and is not replaced by younger people. So we're in a race against time here. We do have the technology for the first time in history to put our entire energy generating system onto a, shall we say, green basis. We just have to redouble our efforts to shut down the remaining reactors in this deteriorating fleet.
Some people would suggest that we're in a race against time for two reasons, not just because of declining safety and the risk of meltdowns and those sorts of disasters, but because of the risk of climate disaster on the planet as a whole, which some people say it's already too late, but certainly many people agree that at some point it will be too late. But nonetheless, it's an incredible example, especially if it's not too late, of abolishing something disastrous and replacing it with a beneficial alternative. And of course, that's what this conference is going to be about, abolishing war and replacing it with positive alternatives. But other than the example of, you know, the model, are there connections between nuclear energy and abolishing war?
Oh, absolutely. Nuclear energy is a war technology. It grew out of the military, the old Atomic Energy Commission. The nuclear power was originally just window dressing for the bomb industry. And it continues to be in many ways. Although I think in this case the genie that came out of the bottle took over. And you have to remember that nuclear power plants, commercial reactors, of which I say there are about 400, are really just standing nuclear bombs. And they allow the terrorists, such as they are, to they're really pre-deployed nuclear weapons, where it used to require a huge infrastructure to develop atomic bombs and deploy them. Now we have these commercial reactors, which, God forbid, could be turned into nuclear bombs themselves. So the reversal. Also, by the way, David, much of the war that we fight in the current world is about energy. And if we can transform the energy system into a decentralized, locally owned phenomena, which photovoltaics, wind power, LED lighting, and other things like, related solartopian technologies allows, then one of the major incentives for war will be eliminated. The wars for oil and gas become obsolete if we are generating our power with solar panels. Nobody's going to go to war over a solar panel. Well, maybe they will, or a windmill, but, at this point in time, it doesn't look likely, let's put it that way.
Well, I'm inclined to very much agree, Harvey Wasserman, but to the extent that the United States, even since before there was a United States, has been seeking greater and greater domination of territory, domination of the continent and then of the rest of the world, it's possible, of course, that wars would continue, even if we eliminated fossil fuels as a justification or an excuse or a motivation for wars. And it seems that the wars themselves, at least now, are among the greatest causes of environmental destruction through the radiation and the toxins and the poisons and the fossil fuel consumptions of the military, and yet there's virtually no connection between those opposing the military and those opposing environmental destruction, and the big environmental groups just will not touch opposing wars and militarism with a 10-foot pole. And I'm wondering if you know of any potential for connections between two movements that would be stronger together.
Yes, we have done that. And David, recently I was on the good ship Golden Rule, which, as you know, in 1958 attempted to sail into the nuclear test zone in the Marshall Islands. The crew was arrested and the boat was imprisoned, but another boat, they inspired the Hiroshima Phoenix to go into the Marshall Islands and slow down nuclear testing. And that boat had a storied history. It was actually sunk and on the bottom of Humboldt Bay for a while, but it's been restored. And not long ago, actually in early June, I was on the Golden Rule in Portland, Oregon. And we sailed against the warships, and we just sort of, we didn't blockade them at this point, but we were actually hit by a police boat. But we sailed around the warships and displayed our Veterans for Peace and our peace symbol. And I did a radio show from the deck in the middle of the pouring rain from the Golden Rule. And one of our principal spokesperson, a woman named Mimi Gurman, who is not only working against the warships, but also for the shutdown of the Whoops 2 reactor, which is the last one in the Northwest. So I think we see last one operating in the Northwest. And, of course, it's at the Hanford nuclear weapons site, which is a tremendous blight, a poison, boil on the planet. So I think the confluence of the two issues, certainly in the Northwest and elsewhere, is pretty clear. I know that in my 43 years of working against nuclear power, there's always been a dimension of working against nuclear weapons. It's always been a presumption that the two issues are interlocked. And now, of course, since we've experienced the Iraq war and the insanity in the Middle East over wars for energy, if we're in a position now to undercut all that, it will be a very interesting transition to see what other things our human species can come up with to fight wars over.
They'll come up with something. I unless we stop the mentality that says wars are okay, they'll come up with reasons for the
wars. Yes, absolutely.
There is a growing movement, Harvey, a young and growing movement among especially the non-nuclear weapons nations to ban nuclear weapons, because the nuclear weapons nations are not complying with the non-proliferation treaty that requires them to disarm. I wonder if any environmental organizations are likely to join in a movement that's not being led by the U.S., Russia, China, France, Britain, but by other countries that's pushing for a ban on nuclear weaponry.
Well, I've had the incredible good luck and good fortune to be involved with Greenpeace since 1990, and that has always been, part of our ethos is to oppose both nuclear weapons and nuclear power. And we're continuing with that. I was just in our annual general meeting with our wonderful executive director, Annie Leonard, and this has been a dual agenda. Well, of course, with the name Greenpeace since our birth, and I think that people are getting the message pretty clearly. And of course, one of the ways we've been fighting nuclear weapons is to go at the production sites. I mean, there's been tremendous opposition to Hanford and Washington and in the southeast, the whole nuclear weapons complex in Savannah and Aiken, and here in Ohio, where I'm speaking to you from, it, Fernald and Portsmouth and the Mound and Ashtabula sites, which are all nuclear weapons sites in Ohio. We have been well aware of the environmental impacts of those places, as well as the insanity of the weapons they produce. So there has been a confluence, I think, over the years, maybe not as strong as it should be. You look at the great work of Bob Alvarez in D.C., who has been a tremendous researcher both on the nuclear weapons and the nuclear power complex. I think it's a small planet, and nuclear weapons have been killing people for decades without even exploding, and we have to confront that reality. And I think the joining of the two movements is pretty obvious.
Yeah, well, Greenpeace is the perfect name for an organization and a perfect potential for combining the two. What do you make of reports? Correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding in recent months and years, there are a number of dictatorships in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia among them, looking at building up nuclear power, which many see as, a step to put your government, your nation, within reach of nuclear weaponry. That seems like a trend in the wrong direction, and you're describing this wonderful trend away from nuclear power.
Well, it's utterly insane, of course, and recently Russia signed a deal with Nigeria to sell at $80 billion worth of commercial reactors. I mean, there's a very high skepticism that it'll ever happen. One of the great things, the only great things about nuclear power plants is that they are incredibly expensive and take forever to build. And so the idea of the Saudis building a nuclear power plant is terrifying, but I think it's stoppable. I mean, you have to remember also that the French in the late 70s were about to sell 36 reactors to Iran before the Ayatollah threw out the Shah. So, and we're all concerned about both China and India building more reactors. We know that there are popular movements in both those countries to stop it from happening. So this, David, is part of the mission of our activism, and we're going to have to go into these countries somehow, prevent these things from happening.
So when you talk about the imminent or at least near future elimination of nuclear power, you're talking about in the United States alone?
And Europe. Europe is going faster than the U.S. As you know, Germany had 19 reactors after Fukushima. They shut 8 and have a very clear path to shutting the rest of them. And their transition to renewables has been spectacularly successful, serving as a role model for the rest of the world. I think the next country to go that direction will be California. We're on the brink, we hope, of shutting the last two reactors in California, plus Whoops 2 in Washington, which will give us a nuclear-free West Coast, and will pave the way, we hope, for not only a renewable revolution, but also, ridding ourselves of the nuclear weapons infrastructure. So, I'm a born optimist. I like to talk. I don't see the point of pessimism to a certain extent, except maybe to give us a dose of reality. So it's a horse race, David. We have to shut these reactors before they blow up, and we have to shut down the nuclear weapons industry and the rest of the armaments business before we have still more wars. Who knows who's going to win, but our survival certainly depends on it.
Yeah, but as the countries that have tried nuclear power get rid of it for economic reasons and safety reasons, it makes these other countries that are picking up nuclear power look that much more transparently as using it as a step toward nuclear weaponry, or as Japan has referred to it, having a bomb in the basement, having the potential to threaten somebody with developing nuclear weaponry. And that scares me.
Well, it should.
Yeah.
As well it should. That means we have to just redouble our efforts. I do think as Martin Luther King said, the arc of justice is long, but it bends in the right direction. And I think that's the same is true of ridding the world of nuclear weaponry.
Well, we non-believers have to just try to make it bend in the right direction because we don't know which way it's going to bend and don't have a crystal ball. But I, much as I want to go on with this topic, I wanted, Harvey, and we had talked about whether you could give us a quick overview on the state of verifiable elections and open and fair elections in the United States? I mean, have these primaries and caucuses been at all up to civilized standards in terms of open, fair, and verifiable elections?
Well, I will tell you without hesitation that the 2016 primary season, especially on the Democratic Party side, has been a mockery of democracy. I mean, we have at least 10 states where the exit polling and the various polling is completely out of the range of margin of error with the actual vote count, including California, where millions of votes were not counted, including especially in New York City, where at least 100,000 voters in Brooklyn were turned away. We have a system that, in no way of elections, that in no way, shape, or form, in this country, can be counted or even evaluated as democratic with a small D. And the primary culprit, well, there's two culprits, and we've just Bob Patrakis and I have just published our sixth or seventh book, but we lost count, on election protection, and it's a twofold path to dictatorship, basically. First, the stripping of voter rolls, and then the flipping of electronic vote counts. And throughout the United States, especially with the repeal by the Supreme Court of the Voting Rights Act, millions of people are being deprived of their legitimate right to vote, stripping electronic voter rolls, photo ID, a wide range of other harassment techniques, stripping of precincts, failing to deliver electronic voting machines or even paper ballots. It's a disaster. It's a nightmare. I first became acquainted with it in 2004 when we witnessed the theft of the 2004 election. Greg Palast and Bev Harris reported on it from Florida in 2000. Bob Patrakis and I saw it here in 2004. The only good thing we can say about George W. Bush, by the way, David, is that he was never elected by the American people. And, you know, to know that these two presidential elections were stolen really puts a crimp on our view of democracy, and it's only gotten worse. More than 50% of the votes in this country will be counted in the fall of 2016 or cast in the fall of 2016 on electronic machines. These machines are more than 10 years old. They're extremely easy to hack. We had one group from the University of Michigan that took a voting machine and got it to play the University of Michigan fight song. Somebody else has been playing Pac-Man on these machines. I mean, it's a joke. And at the same time, as I say, mostly African-American and young voters, along with Hispanics, have been deprived of their votes in many different ways. What we need, Bob Patrakis and I put out an Ohio plan, that's what we call it anyway, in recognition of what happened here in 2004, everyone is automatically registered to vote at the age of 18. You get a form at your school or the Bureau of Motor Vehicles or the supermarket, wherever. You mail it in with your signature. The electronic vote poll books are transparent and have paper backups. We have a four-day national holiday for voting so that everybody can come out without missing work. That will be a Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday. We have no photo ID requirement. People sign, give their signatures. It's a five-year felony if you double vote. There's no history in recent times in the U.S. of any kind of significant double voting. And then finally, we worked the polls with those 4 days with students, college and high school students, and elders in tandem and paid them $15 an hour to run the polls and then count the votes. And then finally, we have universal hand-counted paper ballots. It's done in Germany, Canada, Ireland, Romania. And the votes are dropped into transparent boxes. They don't go anywhere. And then the students and the elders sit there and count the votes. And that's where no more electronic voting machines, no more photo ID requirements, plenty of time for people to vote. And it's really a parallel movement in many ways to the renewable energy industry, where we're trying to get rid of, in many ways, electronic voting machines are the commercial, the Fukushimas of real democracy. And we don't have a real democracy here. You know, it's one thing, it's important that we get money out of politics, but even more important than getting money out of politics is to have a system of casting and counting votes that actually makes sense. What we have now is nothing even resembling that, and the primary season has been a disaster in terms of disenfranchisement and, you know, dubious vote counts, let's put it that way.
Well, I love your set of reforms. Just have a few minutes left. I love your set of reforms, but they sound like they're aimed at general elections. It seems in primaries you've got to deal with the question of whether to have these things called caucuses or not, whether to have these people called delegates or not, whether to have superdelegates piled on top of them that aren't voted for at all, whether to let people who are not a member of the party vote in the party's primary, or in the case of California, let them vote but make them vote on provisional ballots and then not count them until, you know, sometime long after the winner's been announced. What is the fair way to do the primaries?
Same way. I mean, you know, everybody should be equally registered. You should be able to go in, vote on a paper ballot and for whoever you want in whatever party you want. And you're right about California. They completely disenfranchised millions of people in California who wanted to vote in the Democratic primary and couldn't. And these provisional ballots are a joke. They go straight into the trash. Nine times, well, I won't give us the statistic, but a very high percentage of them are just pitched. And, you know, we simply don't have what could be called an actual democracy in terms of the mechanics of counting and casting our votes. And that has got to change, David. I'm much more concerned about that than I am about Koch brother money funding campaigns. We can beat that. But you can't be a system where the votes are counted by partisans who will have ample ability to rig the vote count and to keep people from voting in the first place. That is not sustainable, and any more than commercial reactors are sustainable. And I see the two movements as being very parallel.
And I'm inclined very much to agree with you. What's the name of the book, and where do people get it?
The book is called The Strip and Flip Selection of 2016. It's at freepress.org. The subtitle is 5 Jim Crows and Electronic Election Theft. And it's actually pretty short, David. We do it based on PowerPoints. So you can read through this book pretty quickly if you don't drop dead from your blood boiling, which I had to put in a cooling system while I was writing it, but, you know, this is the reality, and we've been on this case, Bob and I, since 24, and Greg and Bev were 4 years earlier. So this is something that we all have to deal with as Americans. And we want to abolish the Electoral College. We want to end money in politics. We want to get rid of gerrymandering. But until we get a decent vote count, nothing's going to happen.
How about, I think you've hit all of the most important ones, but there are many more reforms I'd love, including shortening the darn election season a little bit so that there's some period of just governance in between elections. What do you make of that proposal?
What a concept. Governance. Whoever thought.
Well, yeah, not much thought of. Harvey Wasserman, as always, wonderful work. Keep in touch with us. Solartopia.org is the place to go for the vision of how we ought to be living and may be living in the near future if we survive a number of hurdles. Harvey, thanks for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Well, thank you, David, and thank you for your fantastic work. Much appreciated.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Countersmith.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, UK politics are up in the air in the wake of a referendum calling for Britain to leave the European Union. The so-called Brexit campaign is drawing comparisons to that of Donald Trump due to the nativism and racism that marked it. But what else is at work here? Joe McAray is publisher of Truthout, the news organization. He'll join us to talk about that. Also on the show, for those of us used to the objectivity school of journalism, in which reporters pride themselves on being so neutral they don't even vote, the rise of unabashed advocacy journalism isn't just a breath of fresh air, it's a welcome end to a charade. Still, the industry doesn't make a habit of rewarding work that really takes a stand. The Danny Schechter Global Vision Award for Journalism and Activism, established by Schechter's longtime media partner Rory O'Connor, takes a step in a different direction. Rory O'Connor will join us to talk about how the Danny and its first recipient honor journalism that does more than just tell a story. All of that's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press. When CBS head Les Moonves chuckled that the mean-spirited, myth-driven, racist and misogynist candidacy of Donald Trump, quote, may not be good for America, but it's damn good for CBS, that's all I got to say, close quote, he was laying bare the lie that there's no relationship between corporate media's profit motive and the humanity of the conversation they encourage. Moonves said he wasn't taking any side, but he was. And that divide has been further exposed by CNN's recent hiring of Trump's fired campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski. Lewandowski's job involved enforcing Trump's blacklist of media he disliked and confining reporters to a pen during campaign events. He shoved and threatened to pull credentials from a CNN reporter who defied the edict, and he grabbed and restrained reporter Michelle Fields, which led to criminal charges that were later dropped. Not too surprising, then, to read accounts saying female and Latino reporters, especially within CNN, were protesting the hire. But Washington Post reporter Paul Farhi countered with comments from a prominent staffer who told him, quote, I get the argument that he was a bully, but I also get why we hired him. There aren't many people who know more than him about how Trump's campaign thinks and works. That could be very valuable to us over the next few months, close quote. Well, the problem with that is that Lewandowski has likely signed a non-disparagement agreement. He won't say whether he has or hasn't. And it doesn't matter, say folks like former NPR ombud Alicia Shepard, whose op-ed in USA Today called the hire, quote, a smart move for CNN, which is, after all, a business dependent on increasing viewership, close quote. This isn't rocket science, Shepard says. Quote, it's political theater, and you have to have big names to fill the seats. Lewandowski will do just that, close quote. Well, maybe. But if that's all it is, why wouldn't CNN just go to an all-explosion and naked people schedule? Both of those have been known to draw in viewers. But wait, wait, there's more. Another CNN reporter told The Post, putting Lewandowski on the payroll could improve CNN's access to Trump. Well, Trump hasn't been shy about interviews, and CNN hasn't been stingy in covering him, even airing empty podiums at which Trump was scheduled to speak over other candidates actually speaking. But still, the hire can't hurt with resolving issues with his campaign, the source says. So there you have it. Hiring someone for your news channel who is deeply, sometimes physically, opposed to critical journalism is clever, because it might help ensure you can continue to give his former boss a platform. a boss whose attitude toward the press is expressed in the statement, quote, "I would never kill them, but I do hate them," close quote. It's worth noting that the same USA Today with Shepard's column carried a piece by the paper's media columnist Rem Ryder, who, unlike Shepard, sees meaning in Lewandowski's pronounced disdain for the enterprise he's now being paid to be part of. Ryder says the hire, quote, "encapsulates the utter bankruptcy of practice that is awful, but nevertheless has become a widely accepted part of the scene," close quote. And finally, the June 16th Wall Street Journal carried an eye-catching story. Environmental groups change tune on nuclear power. Focus on climate change has raised profile of reactors, now viewed as reliable, carbon-free source of energy. Interesting, if true, as the saying goes, and it's not. As Miranda Spencer reports for Affair.org, Journal reporter Amy Harder's evidence for a shift in attitude by green groups consists of vague assertions that the Sierra Club, quote, "is debating whether to halt its longtime position in support of shuttering all existing nuclear power plants," close quote, and that the Environmental Defense Fund is deciding to what extent it should adjust its policy. The piece is framed by two sources, Joe Dominguez from Exelon Corporation, the country's biggest electric holding company and operator of its largest fleet of nuclear plants, and Michael Schellenberger, co-founder of the quasi-neoliberal pro-technology environmental think tank, the Breakthrough Institute. A central point is the idea that big eco groups are working with Exelon to reverse a decision to close two reactors in Illinois, and in the journal's words, quote, "ensure that the reactors remain in operation by providing financial recognition for the zero carbon electricity they produce," close quote. Well, Harder makes multiple reference to this false claim that nuclear power is carbon free. Spencer cites the Nuclear Energy Institute, who lobby for industry, acknowledging that while nuclear facilities don't emit greenhouse gases when they generate electricity, the processes used to build and fuel the plants do. So yes, nuclear energy's greenhouse gas footprint is bigger than renewables. As for that Illinois angle, the director of the state's Nuclear Energy Information Service told Spencer the Wall Street Journal is over the top outrageous. Eco-activists, he said, are negotiating not so that those plants would be kept in operation, but whether they will. The Natural Resources Defense Council, also cited in the story, say that it was dead wrong on our goals, focus, and motivation. And the Sierra Club stated that that group remains opposed to dangerous nuclear power. Well, it's true that there have been some prominent individuals in the scientific community who've spoken up for what they call newer, safer nuclear technology. Their claims can be addressed on their own terms. But in conflating the pro-nuke positions of a few with the sentiments of major environmental organizations, Spencer suggests, the Wall Street Journal might just be telling the story they hope to hear. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The story of masses of Britons Googling "what's the EU" seems to be apocryphal, unsurprisingly, but it is fair to say many people were shocked by referendum results calling for Britain to leave the European Union. In the wake of the vote, some say many proponents of a so-called Brexit didn't really expect it to happen. So how did it? And what is there to be learned from the echoes between the racism and nativism demonstrated and exploited by some Leave campaigners and certain stokers of those same sentiments closer to home? Joe McAray is now publisher of the nonprofit news organization Truthout. He co-edited the anthology "Who Do You Serve? Who Do You Protect? Police Violence and Resistance in the United States." He joins us now by phone from Chicago. Welcome to Counterspin, Joe McAray.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
In making sense of the results, many are starting with groups like UKIP and Britain First, the outwardly nativist and racist people, represented perhaps by the person who killed Joe Cox. In your essay for Truthout, you don't discount that influence at all, but it's not where you start. What are some of the things you think we should think about as helping create the conditions, if you will, for the vote to leave?
One place to start is that for at least 20 years, both of the dominant two parties in the UK, the Conservative Party and Labour, particularly in the New Labour iteration of that party, which came into being under Tony Blair and took power in 1997, those parties have been willing to make various degree of dog whistles or increasingly over time, outright scaremongering rhetoric about immigration in an attempt to win votes. And according to those parties, it's been to ensure that far-right parties, for a long time that was the British National Party, now it's more Britain First, and UKIP, who are a sort of respectable version in some ways of those far-right parties. Mm-hmm. The mainstream parties have been very willing to use xenophobic, anti-immigrant rhetoric to one degree or another to ensure that they win votes, and also as a way of redirecting resentment as their economic policies have caused poverty and have created a huge amount of resentment amongst working people in the UK. They need to redirect that resentment to someone, and as always, an obvious target is people who are new to the country. And it's a combination of the kind of Islamophobia we see in the US as well, but also often specifically xenophobia against economic immigrants from elsewhere in Europe, where what's happening is basically a kind of narrowing of the definition of whiteness again to mean that like Polish people living in the UK are suddenly considered other and unacceptable. So I think that like you have to look at how those mainstream parties and the media have really done a huge amount of work in making the kind of racism that's demonstrated by those far-right parties acceptable.
Media play a big role in directing that gaze, don't they? I mean, we certainly see that here. They, in some cases, straight up say, here's who you should blame for the problems in your life.
Right. I mean, a great example of this is the BBC, between a certain period, had Nigel Farage, who is the leader of the UKIP party, on as a guest of their like flagship political discussion show, Question Time. They had him on more than any other figure, more than any other politician, I believe possibly more than any other guest. There's obvious parallels to someone like Donald Trump in the sense that the media play a huge role in legitimizing and giving a platform to and creating the fame of someone, and then retroactively claim, well, we have to cover this person, we have to give him a platform because he's popular.
Right.
And also that a lot of this media purports to be in some way left-leaning or liberal and will then very regretfully say, well, this is terrible, but has in fact legitimized this. And you see it in some of the things that the kind of op-eds that nominally left papers like The Guardian or nominally liberal papers like The Independent have been willing to publish op-eds by people basically saying, well, you know, we need to have a conversation about Muslims living in the UK, or we need to have a conversation about the number of economic migrants. And what that basically doing is making forms of racism and xenophobia into a sort of legitimate voice in a debate.
Yes, there is definitely a special role for the sort of contrarian putative leftist who says, you know, I know that we hate to say this, we liberals, but we really need to. I think of Bill Maher saying, you know, let's just acknowledge that really Muslims are the problem. Well, so it's a cross spectrum in media is what we're saying. Well, and then we come to the EU itself, which has shown up in media stories. I'm seeing people say, well, you know, we talk about sovereignty when we're saying we don't want companies to use trade pacts to override our laws. You know, we do care about sovereignty. And maybe what the Brexit folks were talking about was just the EU as an undemocratic force. What do you make of that? There is something to be said about the role that the European Union has played and is playing.
Right, absolutely. In my article, and I think in any analysis, you have to say that the EU bears a lot of responsibility and that many of the things which could be said about it by people campaigning to leave were true. And many of the things that were said by some of those campaigning to remain were not true. The EU is not a kind of shining beacon of democracy and plurality. The problem is that the leave campaigners were arguing for, and you see this really clearly in the aftermath of what, and it's not what we're going to see in terms of the economic consequences. Right. So it's tempting to see Brexit as striking a blow against the European neoliberal elite, and there's a degree of truth in that. But unfortunately, it's a victory for the British right, and not just in cultural terms, but also in terms of economic policy. What they're already saying is that this will have to result in more cuts, more tax raises on ordinary people. It's not that the economic results in the UK are going to be anything other than austerity and neoliberalism.
Media are going to stay on this story. They can do it well or poorly. What would you like to see U.S. media doing more of, less of, questions they might ask, folks they might talk to? What are some thoughts you have for media?
Paying attention to what's actually going on the ground in the UK is a huge one. There have been some people on the left who have wanted to see this as a sort of victory against neoliberal forces, against the global 0.01%. I think to have that rosy view of it means completely ignoring people on the ground in the UK who are saying this is terrible specifically because of the way in which it has emboldened racism within the UK, which was already there and was already on the rise. But it seems extremely likely, judging from the media reports from the UK, the social media discussions, that has produced a certain increase in that already rising level of racism. Those voices, people within the UK, specifically people within the UK who themselves have experienced this emboldened racism and xenophobia, are some of the most important voices to listen to. And everyone else in the UK who's like directly affected by the economic and other policies of the government there. Because, you know, those are the people who can tell you, are the economic policies that get put in place now, are they in any way preferable to being part of the EU? Are the labor policies that are put in place in any way preferable? So I think those are the voices that U.S. media needs to be paying attention to. And really, now, because of things like social media, there's no excuse not to be paying attention to those people.
Joe Macaray, thank you so much. Joe Macaray is publisher of Truthout, online at truthout.org. That's where you'll find his piece, Who Should We Blame for Brexit and Where Do We Go From Here? Thank you for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
Today's U.S. news watchers might not recognize that the pretense of objectivity in journalism, the view that reporters should strive to report the news as if from nowhere, is, besides not being possible, not a value that adheres to journalism the world around or that has even always held sway in this country. Many of those thought of as the giants of the profession, Ida B. Wells, Lincoln Steffens, were advocacy journalists before that term was considered not just a pejorative, but an oxymoron. Things seem to be changing again, though, with a growing awareness that if taking a side against poverty or racism or climate change means breaking some rule of straight journalism, then it's the rules that ought to change. Our next guest has never separated journalism and social change. Co-founder with the late Danny Schechter of the media group Global Vision, Rory O'Connor is a filmmaker and journalist and author of, most recently, Friends, Followers, and the Future: How Social Media Are Changing Politics, Threatening Big Brands, and Killing Traditional Media. Welcome to Counterspin, Rory O'Connor.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Well, you wear many hats, but I have you here today for a specific reason, which is to talk about the award newly established by your educational foundation, the Global Center. It's aimed squarely at this question of socially engaged journalism. Tell us about the award.
Well, we call it the Danny for short, and it's going to be an annual award. This is the first year we're offering it. And it includes, importantly, a $3,000 stipend to support both future reporting and advocacy work by the winner. And I'm really pleased not only that we've been able to establish this award to remember my late partner, Brother Schechter, but also the initial recipient, Jose Antonio Vargas, is just spectacular. And if your listeners don't know about him, they should find out really, really soon.
Well, tell us about the connections here. What is it about Vargas's work that you think connects it to Danny's? In other words, what are the values of Danny Schechter's life and work, and his birthday was yesterday, June 27th. What are those elements that you hope the award reflects and that you see reflected in Jose Vargas?
I think that this idea of quote-unquote objectivity and false equivalence that you've been talking about eroding in journalistic circles, although it is still somewhat prevalent in the mainstream. But when Danny and I started Global Vision nearly 30 years ago, you know, that was far from the case. You know, the first thing that we did was create a program about apartheid in South Africa called South Africa Now. And we found to our surprise that the fact that the program was anti-apartheid on the face of it was a matter of controversy. And in fact, that we were kept off of the airwaves by public broadcasting service here in the United States for the reason that we actually took a stand against apartheid. The type of thinking that still exists, although it is eroding, and we want to get rid of it entirely. Danny and I actually paid, you know, a fairly significant price. We were denounced in the pages of the Boston Globe, for example, as, quote, hardline Marxist propagandists. And we always felt we had been branded with the scarlet letter A for advocate or activist. And people said we weren't journalists. So we want to encourage more and more people like Jose, who is, after all, a Pulitzer Prize winner from the Washington Post. He has had an outstanding career in journalism, but he's also probably one of the leading advocates and activists in America when it comes to that very hot topic of immigration. He himself is a undocumented immigrant to the United States, what the other people like to call an illegal alien. And he has very proudly and bravely stepped up and announced to the world that he is here and undocumented and that he is not leaving. So he's a leader in that field as well as in journalism.
We do seem to be getting past this idea that advocacy is somehow the opposite of fairness. You know, this idea that, well, how can we possibly judge a piece of work's fairness if it represents a point of view? I think people are coming to understand that you develop critical skills. You don't just designate some outlets good or some reporters good and then believe everything they say. You know, you have to bring critical skills to bear no matter what you're looking at. Do you think that social media is part of how people have just kind of gotten more subtle about it, more critical about it?
Yeah, I think social media has democratized the process, and more people are realizing that, you know, frankly, it's hard to talk about objectivity in journalism with a straight face,
right,
as, you know, one expert, Pat Alfterheide, put it. And, you know, I quote her to that point in an article that's just appeared on Alternate today that I would encourage people to go check out, called A for Activists. So leading theorists like Pat, like Jeff Jarvis, for example, at the CUNY School of Graduate Journalism, and recognize saying if a piece of journalism isn't advocacy, it isn't journalism. After all, what is a journalist if not an advocate on behalf of the public? That being said, you're absolutely right that we do have responsibilities as journalists and as advocates to be fair, to provide balance, to look at the situation and come back to the public and tell them to the best of our ability what we believe is the truth, not what is on the one hand this, on the other hand that, he said, she said. And that's not a truthful way of reporting this so-called objectivity. And I think that we've all now begun to realize it in the age where, thanks to social media, frankly, all of us are potentially journalists.
I think one of you and Danny Schechter's gifts to media criticism and activism was to go from that insider point of view, from working within corporate media, so-called mainstream media, because we talk a lot about owner bias and advertiser bias, and those are real for sure. But one of the things that you shone a spotlight on was just an institutional climate that leads to a timidity within journalists themselves. And I only say that to say –
You're not joking to underscore that there's a stipend with this award, because we have to actually reward different kinds of work, don't we, if we want to encourage them?
We have to reward and we have to encourage it. And I can tell you from my past, from having left the corporate media, the mainstream media, and going independent, that getting resources is always the biggest struggle. Getting the story is hard, but getting the resources to put that story out there in front of the public is even harder. So we felt that it was important not only to honor the work, but to support the work. And I'm very happy that an anonymous donor came forward and has funded the first 5 years of this award. So we are able to offer, you know, a small stipend, but $3,000 in the right hands can be the difference between success and failure.
I want to underscore that although we're saying that we are seeing more and more of people reporting and being recognized as good reporters, and there's no doubt whatsoever that they're expressing a point of view, at the same time, activism, and that includes activist journalism, by definition isn't really safe. And I guess, you know, you could hardly make that clearer than with the inaugural winner, with Jose Antonio Vargas. But it's important to remember that we aren't talking about just doing super good reporting, you know, that's going to win you any kind of award. It's a particular kind of barrier-pushing work that you're looking to honor.
Well, you know, yeah, that's absolutely right. And when we started looking for people who might qualify this year, what we found is that there was a plethora of great candidates, you know, ranging from the people who, you know, revealed the video in Chicago that, you know, led to the police department coming apart, to the firing of the head of the police department, and a lot of pressure being put on the mayor there. There were a number of cases just in the past year of people who had done excellent work from outside the mainstream that, you know, made a huge difference in the journalist world. But these were people who were, quite frankly, self-identified as advocates and as activists. And that's the shift that we're seeing, and that's the shift that I hope that the Danny and the small stipend that comes with it will encourage and will move forward even more rapidly than it's happening now.
We've been speaking with Rory O'Connor. You can find the article, A for Activist, No Longer Journalism Scarlet Letter, on alternet.org. Rory O'Connor, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you, and thank you, FAIR, for existing.
And that's it for Counterspin, brought to you each week by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Erica Bassett and Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Are you ready for the harsh reality of our future in a hotter world? Can any of us really handle the truth? If you feel strong enough, this may be the most devastating look into where we really stand. Perhaps you remember UK writer Mark Linus stunning us with the awful changes on Earth if we warm by 5 degrees centigrade, and we may not survive 6. Many hope the climate talks in Paris can reach an agreement that will save a livable climate for all our descendants and keep global warming below 2 degrees C. But what if the national leaders are just players on a stage of illusion? What if someone told you our current levels of greenhouse gases already commit us to more than 6 degrees of global warming and over 12 meters, over 36 feet higher sea levels? And that may not be the worst of it. I'm Alex Smith with a remarkable interview from London. This is Radio EcoShock, radio you need to hear. A best of Radio EcoShock replay. Humans have a known tendency to either panic and hide or fight against the wrong enemy. So I try to stick to rational voices and back those up with the best scientific proof we can find. Our guest David Wasdell is one of those voices, but now he's poking big holes in mainstream hopes and illusions about saving ourselves from climate change. His latest video and paper is called Climate Dynamics: Facing the Harsh Realities of Now. David Wasdell, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex. Hey, it's always good to work with you on the critical issues that you raise. And to know that our discussion is being heard by a global audience that is both well-informed and passionately concerned. It's a pleasure talking with you.
Well, indeed they are. We've got a fantastic group of listeners, and they are well-informed. So I thought, just to let the listeners know what they're in for, why don't we start with a quick round of kind of yes or no questions?
Alex, that sounds like a great way to set the agenda, but, you know, I can't guarantee one-word answers. Well, let's have a go.
Okay. Number one, world leaders meet in Paris to reach an agreement to keep the world safe from dangerous climate change, even if they agree to all the voluntary goals set by each country. Will that be enough to keep climate change below 2 degrees centigrade of warming?
Absolutely not.
Right. Question two, do we have a comfortable margin of carbon we can burn and still avoid catastrophic climate change?
No. We've overshot that boundary by a massive amount.
Question three, have leading scientists modified science for politicians because the harsh realities of what we need to do are unrealistic?
Unrealistic or unacceptable. Sadly, what you're talking about is correct.
Number four, is it true that the United Nations projections of climate change, including those from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, routinely leave out important warming forces?
That is true.
Is it conceivable, David, even possible, we are setting planet Earth on a path towards heating of 8 degrees or more centigrade, or say 16 degrees Fahrenheit hotter, in the next 100 or 200 years?
Alex, that is exactly where we are headed.
And finally, if we don't wake up and act, can this generation ruin the Earth for humanity and other species for thousands of years?
Yes.
Well, there you have it, listeners. All this is part of a stunning new video lecture and paper called Climate Dynamics: Facing the Harsh Realities of Now. The presentation is by our guest, David Wasdell. He's the director of the Apollo Gaia Project. I've followed David's work for years. In December 2010, we did an interview for a Radio EcoShock show called Beyond the Tipping Point. Wasdell is well-versed in science. He keeps in touch with other scientists around the world. As an independent analyst with no institutional ties, David is free to bring out the climate science few others discuss openly with the public. Well, I've interviewed several psychologists about the human ability to lie to ourselves, but your talk goes much deeper because you're looking at vast institutional fantasies where even science is tempered by a kind of real politic. What did the famous German climate scientist John Schellenhuber tell you about that several years ago?
You know, the idea of an available carbon budget, as we call it, was introduced just prior to the 2009 Copenhagen conference. by a big think tank in Germany, the WGBU, if you translate it, the German Advisory Council on Global Change. The introduction to that report was written by Professor John Schellenhuber, who was the chair of the WBGU Council at that time. By the way, John was one of my initial colleagues at the start of the Apollo Gaia project. But in that introduction, he wrote, "This report is a compromise between what is scientifically necessary and what is politically and economically feasible." Let's do that again. "This report is a compromise between what is scientifically necessary, what the situation demands, if you like, and what can be tolerated politically and economically." See, when key scientists put out reports that have already made that compromise, so that what they report to policymakers is already an appeasement document in terms of what the political and economic vested interests will tolerate, then in my opinion, they've already lost their authority as scientists.
But we do need to keep this carbon fantasy going. Otherwise, David, how will we drive to work or feed ourselves? Why do you think that now is a critical time to face the harsh realities about climate change?
Spot on. But you know, Alex, our patterns of work, our city design, our building architecture, our transport arrangements, food production, population growth, power generation, military strategy, political, economic, and financial institutions have all developed in the context of a virtually unlimited supply of cheap fossil energy. That age is over. Not because we've run out of fossil fuel, it's far from it, but because the collateral damage from burning the vast amounts involved has changed the very composition of the air we breathe and dramatically transformed the energy balance of our planetary home. Digging ourselves out of that hole requires a transformation the likes of which we have never before been faced by our human civilization. And it's urgent.
So let's dive into your work. I found your comparison between changes in Earth temperature and our own body temperature make it easier to understand. How do they compare?
Well, Alex, you know, the planet acts a little bit like your own body. I mean, in response to temperature. You think, if your temperature goes up by, 3 or 4 degrees, you're going into life-threatening stress. 5 degrees, you're probably dead. At 3.5, I don't know, possibly going into delirium. On the other hand, if your temperature drops by about 2 or 3 degrees, you're suffering hypothermia. So you and all of us in this program have a very narrow temperature scale within which to operate. Our bodies are very sensitive to small changes in temperature, and so is the planet. Let's put it this way. Just 5 degrees centigrade marks the difference between 1.5 miles of ice over Ottawa and the bustling capital city we know and love today. 5 degrees, that's all. So in that sense, global sensitivity to temperature change is extremely high. Now, from a different perspective, if you catch flu, your temperature goes up. But if you've got streptococcal meningitis, it goes up a lot further and faster. So there's a sensitivity of temperature to pathogen behavior. And there is also a sensitivity of the body to change in temperature. Two very different sorts of sensitivity. So at a planetary level, we can distinguish between the sensitivity of global climate to changes in temperature and sensitivity of global temperature to changes in carbon dioxide. Make sense?
It does. It really helps, I think, to picture this. A number of scientists, including Dr. James Hansen, have warned that the 2 degrees centigrade limit on warming is not safe at all. In fact, Hansen recently said it was crazy to think so. Do you agree?
Well, Alex, my short answer is yes. My long answer goes on a bit further. Tiny changes in planetary temperature have big effects on global climate. You can see that already with the present increase of just under 1 degree centigrade. Droughts, fires, crop failure across California and other southern states, not to mention Australia. Desertification and collapse of subsistence agriculture in sub-Saharan Africa with starvation, disease, migration, and conflict. Loss of 70% of the floating sea ice in the Arctic. The start of methane release from seabed permafrost. Disruption of the circumpolar jet stream with the weirding of weather across the northern hemisphere. And the northern part of the United States and Canada have seen all about that, with the heating on the western seaboard, intense cold on the eastern seaboard. knock-on effects of that in the monsoon behavior across Asia, with crop failure, multiple farmer suicides in northern India, devastating flooding in some areas, increase in the strength of rainfall and in the power of tropical storms with changes to their normal routes, loss of 40% of phytoplankton around the globe, damage to coral reefs and the ocean food chain. In your neck of the woods, spread of bark beetle with dieback and burn in the Canadian pine forests. The shift from carbon sink to carbon source in the Amazon rainforest with dieback wildfires and the start of the change from forest to savanna. Species extinction running at, what, about 1,000 times normal background rate? Oh, and loss of about 500 cubic kilometers per year and rising from land-based ice. 20 centimeters of sea level rise, which is about a tenth of what's already in the pipeline. Extreme water shortage in the countries around the Mediterranean, with social unrest, escalating conflict, accelerating migration, and economic collapse. Alex, we are way beyond safe climate change already, at just under 1 degree. So a rise of 2 degrees centigrade would lead to over 4.5 meters, about 15 feet rise in sea level, and a multiplication of all the effects we've just been noticing today. The 2 degrees ceiling might give temporary protection to the profits from fossil energy, but it would be a catastrophic commitment for humanity as a whole. So yes, I agree with James Hansen. Setting a rise of 2 degrees centigrade as a global target and calling it safe is sheer madness.
David Wasdell, you explained developing new science on climate sensitivity. How would you define climate sensitivity to the person on the street?
Alex, thank you for asking that. It brings us right back to today and right back to the ground. You know, the very air we breathe is, what, about 4/5 nitrogen and 1/5 oxygen? That makes up pretty well 100%, doesn't it? Those gases allow light and heat radiation through in both directions without any interference. Carbon dioxide itself is a trace gas. The atmosphere contains, what, 0.02% of carbon dioxide by volume. Tiny, tiny amounts, relatively speaking. But CO2 is a greenhouse gas. It allows light in from the sun, but it blocks some of the heat energy from being radiated back out again. And along with water vapor, ozone, and methane, it acts like a thermostat. It controls the surface temperature of the planet within a range of about 35 degrees centigrade. Now, burning fossil hydrocarbons for energy, which is what we've been doing since the Brits started to dig up coal back in the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, burning fossil hydrocarbons for energy increases the concentration of atmospheric CO2. If you like, it changes the setting on the thermostat, and it pushes up the surface temperature of the planet. Now, obviously, we need to calibrate the thermostat. The measure we've chosen is a doubling of the concentration of atmospheric CO2. All right? So the question is, how much does the surface temperature of the Earth go up if we double the concentration of atmospheric carbon dioxide? The answer to that question is what we mean by climate sensitivity. So if the value is pretty low, that's okay. We can emit large quantities of carbon dioxide without pushing the temperature up too far. But if the value is much higher, then emitting even quite small amounts of carbon dioxide has a big effect on temperature. So getting that figure right is absolutely crucial for setting future strategy.
Well, that leads to my next question. How did the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, manage to set climate sensitivity far too low?
Alex, there are two ways to tackle the problem. We can build computer models of the system and read off the resulting predictions. Alternatively, we can look in detail at the relationship between carbon dioxide concentration and associated surface temperature over millions of years of our planetary history. But here I think I need to take a step back and understand a bit more about that thermostat. The effect of change in CO2 concentration on its own is actually known pretty accurately. Trouble is, it sets off a whole host of other mechanisms, what we call feedback effect, that amplify what the change in CO2 does on its own. Now, some of those feedbacks are well known and can be quantified and confidently used in the computer models. Others are known but cannot easily be quantified, if you like, the known unknowns. Then there's a whole set of unknown feedbacks and relationships between them all that are beyond current understanding, the unknown unknowns, if you like. Now, the set of computer models used by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, only work with the feedback mechanisms that can be quantified. It's obvious. Inevitably, that only gives part of the picture. But in contrast, the history of the planet and its change includes, by definition, all the feedback processes, known and unknown, positive and negative, that is amplifying or damping the process, together with all the complex interactions between them. So, computer models predict that the temperature change from doubling the concentration of CO2 would be about 3 degrees centigrade. But using the history of the actual relationship between temperature and CO2 concentration in planetary history, we find the outcome is more like 8 degrees centigrade. That's a huge difference, and it has massive strategic implications. So, you see, the reality of Earth system sensitivity is about, what, 2.5 times that comes from the partial computer models? And, oh, and by the way, then we get into politics and economics that really drive the selection of the facts. The main IPCC report clearly stated that the relationship between predicted temperature and total emissions depends on the value of climate sensitivity. That's correct. But that fact is ignored in the summary for policymakers. And, of course, in the synthesis report that is being used as the basis for the Paris conference starting next month. The low computer-generated value was selected as the basis for strategy against strong academic advice. But, you know, that decision clearly fits the economic agenda of the fossil industry, and I suppose that's what largely controls the political position. You could say it's an example of policy-selected climate science, rather than what we really need, which is science-directed climate policy.
I suppose this means that a smaller amount of carbon dioxide and a lesser rise in global mean temperature will do much more damage than we thought. Is that it?
You're spot on, mate.
Listeners, you're tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. David Wasdell. We're talking about the harsh realities of now, a new presentation that he's brought out about the realities of climate change. A key part of your presentation, well shown in simple graphs, are the layers of feedbacks that amplify the measurements of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. David, could you take some time now to tell us about that? Let's start with the so-called fast feedbacks or Charney feedbacks.
Wow. Alex, it sounds like you're asking for a sort of mini tutorial at this point. Is that okay?
That's exactly what we need, yes.
Okay, well, let's have a go. Hang in here. In order to maintain the energy balance of the Earth, the average surface temperature of the planet has to change by 1 degree centigrade to compensate for about 3.8 watts per square meter of radiant energy that is blocked by change in the greenhouse effect. Got it? Now, if the temperature changed by 5 degrees between the depth of the last ice age and the pre-industrial benchmark, 5 degrees, then it means that 5 times 3.8 watts, 19 watts per square meter, has been blocked because of change in the greenhouse effect and the change in the reflectivity of the planet from changes in the ice fields and so on during that period. 19 watts per square meter. Let's keep that in mind. So what are the elements that gave rise to that change? I'm going to introduce them in sort of layers. I'm going to start with change in solar energy. Then I'm going to add the contribution of carbon dioxide on its own. Then I'll look at the effects of the fast feedbacks, the Charney sensitivity. Explore that later. That's going to be followed by the carbon cycle feedbacks, which we call the Hadley sensitivity, the ice sheet dynamics, named after Jim Hansen, and finally, the full Earth system sensitivity, which includes all the amplifying processes. Okay, let's start. To start with, then, there's a change of about 0.5 watt per square meter in solar energy received during this time because of the change in the shape of the Earth's orbit around the Sun. It's not a lot. That leaves us about 18.5 watts. Keep going. Change in the concentration of carbon dioxide contributed, what, 2.3 watts per square meter during that period? But the Earth system amplifies the effect of carbon dioxide. So if you just look at the contribution from CO2 on its own, we still have to account for about 84% of the change in the planetary behavior. Okay, let's go on. Next, we're putting in the effects of the fast feedback response. We call it the Charney sensitivity, so-called because a guy called Jules Charney was the chair of the original committee that worked on this back in, what, 1979, I think. These fast feedbacks are, firstly, atmospheric water vapor. It's a powerful greenhouse gas, and it increases almost instantaneously with rising temperature. Then cloud behavior changes and increases the feedback. Clouds reflect sunlight back into space. They also reflect infrared energy, the heat energy, back down towards the surface of the Earth. So their behavior goes in two ways. One is a negative feedback, one is a positive feedback. But the amplifying feedback wins. So it's a net amplifier. Thirdly, the area of floating sea ice decreases with rising temperature, and that reduces the reflection of solar energy, so we absorb more energy with rising temperature. These three feedbacks come into action as soon as temperature starts to change. That's why they're called fast feedback. Though, mind you, the resulting heating is very slow. They add about, what, 5 watts per square meter during this period. That still leaves 60%, 58% roughly, still unaccounted for. Oh, by the way, did you know the current set of climate models, the one used as the basis for the fifth assessment report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, deals only with these fast feedbacks? It's amazing to many people. But workgroups 2 and 3 of that report, together with all the subsequent analysis and reports prepared in the run-up to Paris Climate Conference, all share this same methodological dependency. They all use an understanding of climate feedback dynamics that falls short of reality by about 60%. But they persist in using that inappropriate figure as the basis of the international negotiations in Paris. Let's move on. Some of the more sophisticated supercomputer models, like the UK Hadley Centre, which is why we use the word Hadley feedback, Hadley sensitivity, also include some of the effects of the carbon cycle feedbacks, which add about another 3 1/3 watts to the per square metre. But, you know, we're still 41% short of the 19 watts per square metre we need to balance the energy budget. Oh, by the way, the carbon cycle feedbacks are not taken into account in the IPCC advice to policymakers. They're noted, of course, in the main body of the report, but left out in the political advice. And that situation reflects a long-standing policy in the work of the IPCC. It tends to focus on the output from the most basic computer models, while the more sophisticated ones are seen as, like, outliers, and they tend to be ignored. Mind you, using non-modeled historical data, James Hansen, until recently director at NASA's GISS institution, has included long-term ice dynamics. That's the changing reflection from the big land-based ice sheets. Obviously, as the ice sheets melt, they don't reflect the sunlight back, so the Earth heats faster, and that feedback adds another 3.6 watts per square meter. Hey, but you know, even Hansen's work is still about 22% short of the target. So we've got a gap. The dynamics of the planet as a whole, with all its feedbacks, known and unknown, and all their interaction, adds a final 4.1 watts per square meter to the total. And that completes the change of 19 watts per square meter between the depth of the Ice Age and the pre-industrial benchmark. That's the figure we need to be working with in making strategic policies. And it's the ground of what we've come to term the full Earth system sensitivity.
That was a lot, and I'm hoping listeners will download this as a podcast as well and re-listen to that, because I think that's the way to go. And you can get it from my blog at ecoshock.info, the Wednesday of the week that this is broadcast.
And by the way, Alex, you can also get it on the Apollo Gaia website, both as a PDF printout and also as a full video. Did you know that?
Yes. So, all right. So where do listeners go to get that?
Well, we'll probably give that at the end, but it goes on apollo-gaia.org and then goes straight to the first big title on the homepage, which is called Climate Dynamics, Facing the Harsh Realities of Now.
Okay, and I recommend that listeners do that. But first, I'd like to backtrack a little bit into something you just talked about. Please explain a little bit about the carbon cycle feedbacks.
Carbon cycle. Well, as the concentration of carbon dioxide goes up in the atmosphere, many trees and plants go, oh, yippee, this is sort of atmospheric food. And they start to grow a bit faster and absorb more of the CO2. So as the concentration of CO2 goes up and the temperature goes up, we begin to see more CO2 absorbed. But then they get a bit sick of that, and they say, this is too rich. And as the CO2 goes up more, the little stomata on the back of the leaves start to shrink and not so many of them open, and the trees and the plants take in less CO2. So instead of being a growing sink of carbon in the atmosphere, they become a net source of carbon in the atmosphere. And that's pretty critical. There are many, many other carbon feedbacks. For instance, plankton. Plankton absorb a lot of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and turn it into various chemicals in their metabolism. But as the carbon concentration goes up, the phytoplankton don't like the acidity of the resulting ocean surface concentrations, and that damages the plankton. And we've already lost quite a lot of that from around the planet. That means they don't absorb so much carbon from the atmosphere. That increases, therefore, the amount of carbon that stays in the atmosphere. There are a host of little carbon feedbacks, some of them big, some of them small, some of them fast, some of them slow. And Hadley has had a good shot at dealing with some of those. It's probably the best model in the world that does that.
So you say the whole collection of feedbacks amplify the simple effect of adding carbon to the atmosphere by a factor of 8. What does that really mean?
Well, as we've seen, the effect of changing the concentration of CO2 on its own is quite small. But change in temperature it initiates actually sets off a great range of feedback mechanisms, which increase its power by a factor of about 8. It's a bit like feeding a small signal from a microphone into the amplifier of a PA system. That increases the power of the signal and feeds it out into a large auditorium. Does that help?
Yes, I think that's so important to understand, and I didn't really grasp that before going through your paper. So please tell us what doubling CO2 from 280 parts per million, which it was in pre-industrial times, to 560 parts per million, which could happen in the near future, what does that produce as we include each stage of those feedbacks?
Well, I'll do my best. Moving from the specific example of change since the last ice age, we can derive the value of the more generalized climate sensitivity. That's the equilibrium change in average surface temperature of the planet following a doubling of the concentration of atmospheric CO2. Now then, the temperature change required to compensate for the effect of doubling CO2 concentration on its own is about 0.97 of a degree, almost 1 degree centigrade. Okay. Climate sensitivity, when only the fast feedbacks are taken into consideration, puts that up to 3 degrees. When you include the effects of the carbon cycle feedbacks, the sensitivity value goes up to 4.5 degrees as a result of just doubling the CO2. You add in the contribution from the ice sheet dynamics, and that goes up to 6 degrees for the value of climate sensitivity. While the sensitivity value representing the equilibrium dynamics of the Earth as a whole stands at 7.8 degrees following a doubling of CO2. Though I've got a caveat here, which I think is a bit scary. Please note, this figure is derived from slow and close to equilibrium conditions of change in the whole series of glacial-interglacial periods stretching back over a million years. And it may be too low in the current conditions of the Anthropocene. So the figure I'm using in this paper is probably a bit conservative rather than way out and scary. Well, it's still scary, but it's not way out. You know, if you're working with computer models using only fast feedbacks, you predict that 2 degrees centigrade would be achieved at around 440 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. However, if you use, as you really must, the full Earth system sensitivity, then at 440 parts per million, you're going to be looking at about 5 degrees centigrade of change, not 2. You see, I keep reminding you, the computer simulation, inadequate and partial though it may be, is what is still being fed into the process of strategic policy making, on this assumption that the temperature change is only 2 degrees for a concentration of 440 parts per million of CO2. It's an illusion, Alex.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. A best of Radio EcoShock replay.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is David Wasdell from London, England. All right. This is a bit frightening because I remember when Mark Linus wrote his book, What Would Happen at 5 Degrees and What Would Happen at 6, and it looks like we're already committed to 5 or 6 degrees. We'll get to that. Okay, so what is the eventual warming, or as you say, the implicit temperature we can expect from our current level of 400 parts per million carbon dioxide in the atmosphere?
Right. Well, we're just about hitting the 400 parts per million this year, aren't we? It's an extraordinary level to be going above. I don't think many people thought we'd get there that fast. Well, Alex, I've introduced the concept of implicit temperature change as a way of addressing the question, what is the eventual change in temperature to be expected as a result of any specific level of rise in the concentration of atmospheric CO2? It kind of collapses the time dimension and says, well, you know, what we've done is this, the response is going to be that. So today, at 400 parts a million, we have an implicit temperature increase of about 4 degrees centigrade in the pipeline as a result of current concentrations of carbon dioxide. That's pretty clear. But we've also emitted nitrous oxide and ozone and methane and chlorofluorocarbons and hydrofluorocarbons and about 15 other very trace but powerful greenhouse gases from our global use of chemistry. And if you add the effects of all those non-CO2 greenhouse gases together, then there's about 480 parts per million of carbon dioxide equivalent, as we call it, already in the atmosphere. It's adding about 54% to the effects of the carbon dioxide and its feedbacks on their own. So the implicit temperature increase from the full amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere today is about 6.2 degrees centigrade. When it's all worked through to equilibrium. It could take a long time, but that's the implicit change in temperature for which we are now responsible.
But that is fantastic. Are you really saying we're not just doomed to go past the supposed 2-degree safety barrier, which isn't safe, but we are already committed to over 6 degrees centigrade of warming eventually, just with our current greenhouse gases in the atmosphere?
Absolutely correct, Alex, except, and I do need to say that, we're only doomed, as you put it, and I'm not a doom monger, we're only doomed if we decide to do nothing about it. Let's keep that right on the top of our agenda.
Well, leading from that, I think you will agree there's a huge gap, a kind of failure of the human mind that stops us from facing realities like this and taking action to save ourselves. You've called it dynamic inertia, and that acts like a trap in our experience. It fools people into thinking things aren't so bad, the climate disruption must be a long way off. How does inertia work in the world's climate system?
You know, human beings, and that's us, have evolved to react to immediate threat. You know, you see a saber-toothed tiger coming out from the jungle and you go, yow, run, at least faster than the person behind you. I remember being asked what would have to happen to motivate adequate response at a seminar I was at in Seattle. My answer was, if that kind of event occurred, it would already be far too late to take effective action. You see, the inertia of the Earth system is massive. Alex, the observed effects lag far behind the already applied causes. There's a huge time lag. And I think that behavior is ever so apparent when we note implicit temperature change caused by current cumulative emissions stands at 6.2 degrees centigrade, but observed temperature change has only registered, what, about 0.85 of a degree centigrade? Could go up to 1 degree this year with the big El Nino in the Pacific. So explicit observed change stands, what, at about 13, 14% of the implicit eventual change. Over 86% of implicit temperature change is still in the pipeline. Wow. And by the way, sea level change is much harder. Sea level change is sort of subject to a double inertia, isn't it? In terms of what temperature, observed effects lag massively behind applied cause. But in terms of sea level change, the observed temperature change itself, that's the observed temperature change itself, acts as cause. And the change in sea level lags massively behind the change in observed temperature change. And the temperature change lags, in turn, massively behind implicit change in temperature. And that is driven by the fundamental cause of systems change, namely our total cumulative human-driven carbon emissions. Let's put this quantitatively. Observed temperature change of 0.85 degrees centigrade implies a sea level rise of 2 meters. That's what's in the pipeline now, of which only 20 centimeters, that's about 10%, has actually occurred so far. Then think, 0.85 of a degree centigrade is only about 14% of currently implicit temperature change. So observed rise in global sea level of just 20 centimeters represents just under 1.5% of the current implicit change in global sea level. Over 98% of implicit rise in sea level is still to come. I want to just go do a bit of an aside here, Alex, may I? Yeah. You know, it's imperative that the implicit changes, what we're really in for, are taken as the basis for current decision-making. I sometimes say, you know, we have to stand at the bar of history and say, we knew the implicit change resulting from what we are doing to the planet is this. Yes, we'd only observed a tiny amount of it, but we knew this lot was coming and was inherent in what we had done. Do we really dare to stand at the bar of history and say, we knew these levels of temperature change, these levels of sea level change, were going to be the outcome of our strategic decision-making, and yet, in the moment, we refused to take them into account? It's crazy.
All right, let's move ahead further into the implicit rising seas. We have a huge impact with an even bigger delay built in. I'm talking about rising sea levels, and some of my scientific guests say that rising seas may have even more impact on human civilization than rising temperatures. How do you see rising seas reshaping the geography of the world?
You know, I think that's one of the most important risks we face, to be honest. There's a series of recent studies that provided a pretty reasonable, robust rule of thumb that says about 2.3 meters of eventual change in global sea level will occur for each 1 degree change in average global surface temperature. What's 2.3 meters in about 7 feet, I suppose, is it? You know, if the current implicit change in global surface temperature, which stands at 6.2 degrees, then the current implicit change in sea level stands at 14.25 meters, of which only 20 centimeters has been observed to date. Wow, we're going to have a rise in sea level. Let's put a barrier around the seaward front of Venice that'll protect Venice from about 1 meter of sea level change. How unrealistic is that? The so-called safe ceiling of a rise of 2 degrees would lead to an increase of 4.6 meters of sea level. Doesn't sound safe to me. And by the way, if cumulative total emissions could not be reduced below the level to which the current set of promises put up for the Paris conference would lead, then the implicit increase in average global surface temperature will be just over 10 degrees centigrade, not 4 as predicted by the Intergovernmental Panel, and that would be reflected in an implicit rise in global sea level of over 23 meters. Alex, that's the best that's on the table for the Paris Climate Conference.
You're talking about the height of tall buildings.
Yeah.
Oh, Oh, this isn't good. So, David Wasdell, is there a way to know the pace and the destination of these implicit sea level rise? Do we know how fast, really know how fast it will come?
Well, historically, you know, the pace of ice melt, and therefore the change in sea level, has danced in tune with the multi-thousand-year timescales reflecting astronomical changes in orbital shape and the tilt and wobble of the Earth's axis of rotation. It's been very slow. Today, the pace of ice melt is driven by rapid increase in global temperature, not slow astronomical change. It's about 2,500 times the astronomical pace. So we have absolutely no historical precedent by which to predict the timing and the rate of sea level change. It's likely to be exponential. The faster it goes, the faster it goes, tiddly-pom, and much more rapid than current models suggest. So while, for instance, the IPCC may be looking at about 65 centimeters by the end of the century, some of our scientists are saying it could be 3 or 4 meters by the end of the century. And if the rate of change in temperature really takes off, and it's meant to, by all accounts, then it could be more than that by the end of the century. I don't like it.
Meanwhile, at various conferences, in the business press and in scientific circles, there's been a lot of effort to work out how much more carbon we can still burn in the form of oil, gas, and coal, and still remain below this 2-degree warming limit. We've talked about how silly that is in a way and how dangerous that is. And no doubt diplomats at the Paris conference will still talk about this carbon budget. How much of a budget do we really have left?
Or do we have any at all? That's the $64 trillion question, isn't it? Well, let's start like this. At present, CO2 concentration stands at 400 parts per million. Okay, we know that. If it's thought to be safe to go up to 440 parts per million, then we've got a good budget to play with, haven't we? So there's still plenty of room in what I call the skyfill site. However, if we don't depend on the inadequate computer models and instead, as we really should, apply the full Earth system sensitivity, then we are already committed to passing, or at least we were already committed to passing the 2-degree ceiling when CO2 concentration stood at, wait for it, 334 parts per million. That's over 60 parts per million less than the current concentration. It was back in 1978. So we've already overspent the budget, as they call it, by a huge amount. We're bankrupt. You getting the picture?
David, how did you work out your real carbon budget, and what do you base these calculations on?
Okay. I'll be as brief as I can, Alex. Let me explain available carbon budget like this. If we estimate temperature impact of what we've already emitted is, say, X degrees centigrade, and we need to keep the increase to not more than 2, then if we estimate between X and 2 there's still significant space in the skyfall site, then that is the budget. How much more can we dump in the skyfall site and be safe? But you know, once that available carbon budget is established, we have one almighty punch-up in the international community. And this is the process of the huge COP conferences. You know, some are saying, look, we've got the right to emit. No, we have the right to emit. This is not equitable or just. We want differentiated responsibilities. Look at the history of who has put out what. Look at our needs. We are developing countries. Oh, we depend for our survival on income from fossil industries. You can't take that away from us. Look at sea level rise. We've lost our livelihood. We've got nowhere to live. So this group of conflicted interests is trying to wrangle over how to spend an assumed budget, which probably doesn't exist. Okay, so how do you calculate available carbon budget? Well, here's a summary. There's a lot in my video and the PDF, but this is about 4 or 5 lines of summary. We know pretty accurately how much carbon has been emitted since the start of the Industrial Revolution. Okay? That gives us a figure for the implicit temperature increase. If we stick to inadequate computer values for climate sensitivity, then the IPCC estimates a remaining carbon budget of, what, about 250 gigatons of carbon before we pass the 2-degree boundary? using the full Earth system sensitivity shows we've overshot that boundary by, what, 323 gigatons of carbon? We've probably got to put the ceiling back from 2 degrees to 1 degree, and that increases the overshot, the bankruptcy, to a total of 464 gigatons of carbon. And even that doesn't take into account non-CO2 greenhouse gases that add about 54% to the effects of CO2 emissions. So there's a way there, and it's much more detailedly set out in the resources you have available. Let's go on.
All right, that's at apollo-gaia.org. You can watch the full video and really tune into the science of this. So I do want to ask you this rather harsh question because I think it could become a reality. What has to happen for the world to warm a full 10 degrees centigrade?
We have to give up dealing with the problem is the first answer. National promises, the independent nationally determined contributions, or INDCs as they're called, concerning reductions in CO2 emissions, have all been tabled ahead of COP21 in Paris. Alex, those promises look like pushing us up to about 700 parts per million by the end of the century, if they're implemented. And I guess there's no guarantee about that whatsoever. Business as usual, what we're literally committed to at the moment, is driving us towards more like 800 or 900 parts per million up there. And if we can't improve the levels of promised emissions reduction, then IPCC says, hey, we might hit 4 degrees centigrade using its low value for sensitivity. But if we use the full Earth system sensitivity, which we really should be doing by now, to examine the way the climate behaves at a level of 700 parts per million, we're not looking at around 4 degrees. We're looking at an increase of more like 10 degrees as a result of the best promises on the table in Paris. That's twice the temperature shift between the depth of the last ice age and the pre-industrial benchmark. And if we're not able to cut back on our current business-as-usual behavior, then temperature rise increases to more like 12 or even 15 degrees. And by the way, 2 or 3 times that amount in the Arctic. Alex, that means goodbye all the ice on Earth. Welcome to something like 90 feet of sea level rise when all of the Greenland ice cap and the whole of Antarctica melts at this level. Human civilization would have collapsed ages before we reached that. London and New York would be underwater, and so would a lot more of the world.
Now, you haven't left it at that. You have some advice on strategy and on stabilization. I'd like to get to that. A small group of scientists will advise UK Prime Minister David Cameron and all the world leaders on what to say at the Paris COP21 climate summit in December 2015. If you wrote that report for leaders, what strategy would you recommend?
Well, some responsibility. Hey, this whole presentation was actually conceived at an event organized by the Global Leaders Academy way back in spring this year. I think the task of leadership in this context is truly awesome. Alex, you referred to world leaders attending the Paris summit, but you know, they attend in their role as national representatives. And however well-intentioned the wording of the final communique, each leader is present at that conference to fight for the best interests of the nation they represent. It's a struggle group. In a sense, they're fighting over limited resources and trying to minimize threats to national interests. True global leadership steps up a level. It has to. It has to recognize the overall planetary scale of the crisis, the resolution of which requires collaboration to triumph over competition. National interest bows to the overarching requirements of global survival, the achievement of which is ultimately in the best interest of each and every one of the nation states involved. I think maybe nation states evolving is also critical here, don't you? Yeah. Freudian slips sometimes tell us a lot. But to return, look, you have a request for a scientific briefing for those leaders. Now, at the moment, every report, every paper being prepared and presented ahead of the Paris conference has a threefold mantra. 1, 2 degrees ceiling. 2, budget approach to negotiations. 3, strategy of goal achievement by reduction of carbon emissions. And the pressure to collude with that party line is phenomenal. You dare step out of line. Can I say this? any agreement reached in Paris on those terms would be a strategic disaster. It would commit humanity to a course of action that would guarantee catastrophic climate change, with all the unmanageable consequences that would involve. And, Alex, there is also profound pressure to determine strategic response by reference to currently observed changes in the global climate system. That's grossly inadequate as an approach when we're dealing with any complex system subject to the kind of massive time delays between cause and effect that we've already noted. So strategic response must be ordered by the scale of implicit change in system behavior rather than by reaction to minor systems already presenting themselves for observation. So what are the conclusions? And this is how I'd put them in the report. It's now abundantly clear that limiting temperature change to 2 degrees cannot be achieved by emissions reductions on their own. There is no available carbon budget. It's already massively overspent. We're bankrupt even for the 2-degree centigrade target. Moreover, the 2-degree centigrade target has been set far too high. It's far too dangerous. It must be reduced from 2 through 1.5 to 1 at the very most, and possibly even further, if we're going to avoid dangerous climate change and so conform with the globally agreed terms of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. Yes, emissions reduction is a necessary but not sufficient step towards climate stabilization. In addition, it's now imperative to draw down much of the stock of emitted greenhouse gases already in the atmosphere. What does that mean? Well, it means we've got to move beyond reduced emissions and a low-carbon economy, pass through and beyond the zero-carbon economy, and then achieve a substantial carbon drawdown economy at a global level and within the shortest possible time frame. It's a kind of demand that moves us beyond the current one-dimensional strategy of emissions reduction to an integrated two-dimensional strategy that also includes stock reduction. I think that would be the sort of gist of the report. Whether any of the leaders would be able to understand it and take it seriously in the light of the huge pressure on them is another matter altogether.
Well, I wish we had time to go through your 5-step program to stabilize the climate. I don't think that we do. I'm going to have to ask listeners to go to your video and to read your PDF document that's available on your website to get those 5 steps, because as you can tell, listeners, he's made a lot of sense so far, and the 5 steps, I think, would do it. But I'd like to close out a little bit with the fact that you do have a dream of an alternative civilization for humanity. What is the new source of power that you think can carry us through?
Well, we have to shift from using an energy source that requires drawing out of oxygen from the atmosphere and dumps the waste products back into the atmosphere. And that means we're going to have to face the harsh realities of a transition from fossil energy as a driver of our global civilization to the clean solar energy that is available. Alex, it's time to say no to the dark and toxic energy of the underworld. And it's time to say yes and welcome to the pure and sustainable energy of light. It's a bit poetic, this, isn't it? Photodynamics can outpower, outpace, out-resource, and be cheaper than any amount of energy we get from fossil resources. It's time to break out of our bondage to the past. It's time to embrace the freedom of the sun. It's time to usher in the dawn of solar society. By the way, never in the course of human history have so many been trapped in economic bondage to so few. So the breakout is a transformation. And I think that transition from fossil dependency to solar dependency is an extraordinary shift for our whole species. It's a bit like, you know, introducing photosynthesis in the evolution of plants, which could then take solar energy and transform base chemicals into more complex molecules. But today, we are able to take light energy and transform it directly into electricity, power, heat, and light. It's a kind of metamorphosis I don't see us caught in the death throes of civilization, Alex, merely the demise of an inappropriate mode of civilization. I think we're really experiencing the birth pangs of a new form of humanity. You know, wasn't it that English poet T.S. Eliot who wrote, "Mankind cannot tolerate very much reality"? And time poverty is one of the excuses we use to mask our fear. But thankfully, there's a rapidly growing movement of people around the world who are finding the courage to face the harsh realities of now. And I suppose the video is becoming a catalyst for that momentum. The response has been overwhelming. So it gives me a courage to share a dream of the future. And I'd like to finish with that. It goes something like this, Alex. I have a dream that humanity will break out of its state of denial and find the courage to face the harsh realities of now. I have a dream that as a species, we will look back on this current crisis and celebrate the solutions we were able to put in place and say with pride, that was humanity's finest hour. Alex, that's the dream. Our task is to make the dream come true.
Listeners, you can go to apollo-gaia.org. That's Apollo with one P and two L's and a dash, and Gaia, G-A-I-A.org, to watch this free video with David Wasdell. Please spend the time, learn. It may be the most important hour you will spend this month or maybe this year. You can also download the free summary of the video. And of course, I'll put links in my own show blog published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Or you can just Google Face the Harsh Realities of Now, and David's webpage comes right up at the top of the pile. David Wasdell, thank you so much for taking the time to explain this for all of us.
Alex, thank you so much for the opportunity. Go well.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio Eco Shock. All I can tell you is that I've heard from over 100 previous scientists interviewed on Radio EcoShock the evidence that David Wasdell adds up for us in this talk. It's sobering, depressing, and maybe, yes, liberating. We can only go forward, if we can, when we know where we are right now. Please help get this message out widely. Share David's video link, this program, your own thoughts and activism. You know, giving up is not an option. I'm your dedicated friend, Alex Smith. My thanks to all those who reached out to support Radio EcoShock this week, the people who tweet and Facebook further than I can. Thank you for being brave enough to listen, and let's meet again next week.
Working work for years and years, you're always on the go. You never take a minute off, too busy making dough. Someday you say you'll have your fun when you're a millionaire. Imagine all the fun you'll have in your old rocking chair.
Enjoy yourself. Later than you think. Enjoy yourself while you're still in the pink. The years go by as quickly as a wink. Enjoy yourself, enjoy yourself. It's later than you think.
What I have to tell is a very grim story indeed.
But it does require that we have a moratorium on any new coal-fired power plants.
And over the next 25 to 30 years, we're going to have to phase out those that exist.
What if you knew that every time you flip on your light switch, a mountaintop in West Virginia just blows up?
Enjoy yourself, it's later than you think.
This is CIUT, the Tito Report, and 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Tito, the host, and we're joined by Mr. Glenn Ford of the Black Agenda Report. Thank you, Glenn, for being with us.
Thank you for the invitation, Phil.
I have to say, Glenn, of course, that we want to talk to you about your analysis of the U.S. presidential election, but given the developments in Europe, we can't resist taking advantage of your time to learn what you think of this British vote and the strange aftershocks it is giving off.
Well, I'm delighted to see that President Obama is upset, and most of the world leaders of nations that that are led by folks like President Obama are upset, and Wall Street is upset, and the City of London is upset. And that is cause for people like us, Phil, to be not upset, but quite happy.
There does seem to be a sign of losing their grip here. All kinds of new configurations are coming into being. I want to ask you about all this I shouldn't say crazy, I'm prejudging, but the talk about free trade and the European democratic future. Actually, from here, it looks like they actually constitute a kind of club, and there's a lot of people not allowed in the club, right?
Well, it's a kind of cartel. You know, the anti-Brexit forces put out the mythology that the European Union and its predecessor, the Common Market, were the source of peace in Europe, that the Europeans haven't been killing each other, because they found this commonality in the European Union. Well, what it really amounts to is, first of all, a peace under the dominance of the United States. The Europe could not fall into a war among its own members when they were all totally dominated by U.S. military power after World War II. The EU project, the European project, was a consolidation of the European powers at the top, principally Germany and France, the colonial powers, the recreation of a cartel of the former colonizers, joining forces to make them as a group a real force in the world, although junior to the United States. And so we see that in 2011, with NATO's aggression against Libya, the conversation shifted to how to update and upgrade the European Union's own ready military force that could be used to bring peace and order outside of the boundaries of Europe. And basically, we're talking about Africa, the former colonies. So the EU is another way, or was conceived of as another way, for Europe to rise again as a dominant neo-colonial force in the world, with a military component in addition to, of course, its membership, the membership of most of its members in NATO, mm-hmm. all under the United States. It's a cartel of the same class forces that rule in the individual countries, mm-hmm. that is finance and corporation.
Yeah, and you know there's some within the debate in Europe or in Britain they raise the issue of, well, is there racism involved? However, what you just outlined is basically a racist project. I noticed in the past year that practically every member of the European Union made it a point to fly a few planes over Syria and drop a bomb or two, which to me you couldn't make a clearer expression of racism, since there's no respect at all for the sovereign government of Syria.
It's like a symbolic salute to the project for ongoing white or European supremacy in the world. We're in it too, sir.
Mm-hmm. Again, we're speaking to Glenn Ford of Black Agenda Report. Glenn, you have been following the Black Agenda Report, been very carefully studying the U.S. presidential campaign so far. I guess first thing is, there is a syndrome, isn't there, in American politics where particularly progressives and popular movements get blown away by presidential elections every 4 years. Everybody sort of loses their mind.
Yes, everybody gets lost once again in the duopoly. And it's really kind of pitiful. It's not like being lost in a maze where there are many different paths to go, most of which end up in dead ends. There's two paths, and American political trends and tendencies can't seem to get off of those two corporate trends. And most of, although not all, of Bernie Sanders supporters will find themselves in one of those two corporate lanes. Mm-hmm. But I think that a significant enough number this election cycle will refuse to take the corporate lane and will try to create a real alternative party, mm-hmm. Which of necessity would be a social democratic party. And the United States, being so totally corporate dominated, corporations yes. have real political hegemony in this country.
Yeah, we're seeing
that this will have to be a social democratic kind of party. And there'll be lots of fits and starts and infighting about what social democracy is, in fact. but the project, I think, will begin in some earnest.
Yeah, I took some heart from the fact that someone could challenge for the presidency, for the nomination, and say to the people whether it was true or not that he was a socialist, and then discover that there's a whole bunch of people like that idea.
There seems to have been a really big closet in the United States with all these socialists hiding in it.
I've heard a few introductory speeches for Sanders where the speaker says, "Well, I guess I can come out now," and say, and that's rather heartening. Except that, as you point out, they're in a dilemma. Now, I read your article in the latest Black Agenda Report, and you mentioned that there is this struggle to try to keep the path and keep the faith, and there's been some big meetings, and I believe you might have spoken at one, but I know that you mentioned that Jill Stein, for example, was not invited to help them talk about what course they might take.
Yeah, that was at the People's Summit, which drew in Chicago. It drew about 3,500 activists, a whole lot of different stripes of Bernie supporters, but it was put together by the kind of move on people and Democratic Socialists of America that always fold into the Democratic Party every election season. And in fact, if we're talking about move on types, they never left. They're kind of like a junior left formation of the Democratic Party to soak up energies of people who want to call themselves progressives. Mm-hmm. And they showed their hand by not allowing Jill Stein even to speak. In other words, there will be no alternative, a kind of Thatcherite left.
We Democrats who have semi come out will not go all the way out.
But the Democratic Party understands that they are in crisis, that they can't contain these forces, and they have to go so far as to pretend that they are these forces. Mm-hmm. And we saw a glimpse of that during the Occupy movement, when the party sent out all its little posing as left operatives to become supposedly part of Occupy, which had no discipline and no center, and say that they the Democrats were joining the spirit of Occupy, and we saw Obama adapt the language of Occupy.
Yeah. Sort of like Lyndon Johnson saying, "We shall overcome."
Yeah, of course. if you can't beat them, try to appear to join them.
Yeah, speaking of Glenn Ford.
And in the end, you do, if you succeed in appearing to join them, you do beat them.
You win. I think back to the sort of sad efforts. This has been done before. There was the Jesse's Rainbow, and more that had energy, and that had class, and we were all going to unite. And I don't know what Jesse's doing anymore, but that he ended up totally absorbed, did he not?
Yes, he did, and I don't think he had any intention of doing anything else but carve a bigger sphere of personal influence in the party for Jesse. I mean, how many years after that did we find Jesse as the basically calling himself the personal chaplain to President Bill Clinton?
Yes,
first president of the Democratic Leadership Council, the organized right wing of the Democratic Party, and yet he volunteered to be the chaplain.
Yes, if Sanders people should look into the stark future if they were to go that path. One other thing about the Sanders thing, I want to get your comment. They say, if I'm to believe Washington Post and New York Times, who are sort of in charge of handling Sanders now, I guess, they say that he has a new strategy of he's going to try to get candidates, people like himself, to run. And in the first place he went, I think somewhere in New York, and it looks like that candidate's going to get trampled by the Democratic Party.
Well, that would mean the Democrats trampling another Democrat. What he's shifted into is being a kind of lightning rod for left Democrats to adapt the Sanders Democratic brand, but it's Democrat. It's all in the Democratic lane of this two-lane corporate highway.
I'm curious now, and Mr. Dixon writes, of course, a Black Agenda Report. He is a member of the Georgia Green Party, and he has a long piece advocating that people learn how to organize in their own areas and to actually build an organization as opposed to sort of catching the virus every 4 years. Did I get that?
Well, sure, and it shouldn't have taken the election cycle of 2016 to tell us that. In terms of the Green Party, the Green Party has many tendencies in it. In some places, like Georgia, where Bruce Dixon is the co-chairman, it sometimes looks like the Red, Black, and Green Party. In other places, the Green Party is mainly comprised of environmentalists and such, and in other localities, it's difficult to describe it. And Jill Stein doesn't call herself a socialist, although her platform is definitely social democratic. So there are many tendencies in the Green Party, and they are expressed in the work that the various activists under that umbrella do in their local communities. The project here, the project of 2016, that the events of 2016 have made possible is a national social democratic party to organize those folks who are from the left of the DLC, the right-wing Democrats, who are now so dominant, so hegemonic in the Democratic Party. They're about to elect their third DLC president. First was Bill Clinton, second was Obama, the third one will be Hillary. The new party would the spectrum that it would be organizing would begin on the right-hand side of that party with those Democrats that are to the left of mm-hmm. the DLC, to the left of Hillary. That encompasses the Bernie-crats,
yeah.
But also folks that are to the left of the Bernie-crats as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're talking about a spectrum that encompasses about 40% of the American public. And in any other country in the world, a party that represented 40% of the public would be huge, if not the dominant party in the country.
Mm-hmm. Now that I really like that point in your article that you have these parties and you have the cliques that control them, and but then you have, as you pointed out, 40%. That's a significant number. There's somebody who raises the right banner, says the right things, as we found with Occupy and Black Lives Matter. It doesn't
that would
take...
be the dominant party even in Canada. That would be the dominant party in Britain. It would be certainly the dominant party in France.
Yeah.
Any place that you went. But here it doesn't even have a national organization at all. It is not even defined. And we can only measure it by the people who are not represented by the Democratic Party.
Yeah, and are beginning to be seen and to be heard. I was very taken. You point out that Jill Stein is not, as far as I know, she doesn't describe herself as a socialist, but she found a rather nice phrase in dealing with Bernie. She said that, well, we want a political revolution too, but you can't make a revolution in a counter-revolutionary party.
That's right.
I thought, boy, that's apt.
Paul Street has described the Democrats as becoming the more perfect expression of the ruling class in this country. That is a more perfect expression than the Republicans, whose expression, mm-hmm. the expression on their face has certainly changed in 2016. Face of Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Whose foreign policy positions, if you could call them positions, his pronouncements, certainly seem to be to the left of Hillary Clinton's actual policy.
Yeah, she says a no-fly zone over Syria and corridors, which would mean war.
Sounds like a more perfect expression of the ruling class.
Yeah, she would probably take a bow when you tell her that.
Yes, well, then she has. She charges $250,000 per bow.
Yeah,
when she speaks to Goldman Sachs and such.
Well, Glenn Ford, it's a pleasure talking to you. As far as I'm concerned, you do speak with those 40%. We look forward to reading your articles in the Black Agenda Report, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you, man.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Lad Everett of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, who discusses the failure of Congress to strengthen gun laws in the wake of the latest tragic mass shooting in Orlando, Florida. Sarah Warbelow of Human Rights Campaign, who examines the massacre at Orlando's Pulse nightclub in the context of an ongoing epidemic of hate crimes targeting members of the LGBTQ community across the U.S., and Dixon Osborne of the Center for Justice and Accountability, who talks about a civil lawsuit seeking justice in a U.S. court for the 1973 murder of Chilean singer and activist Victor Jara. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Human rights groups are outraged that the United Nations has taken Saudi Arabia off a blacklist for violating children's human rights in Yemen, where the oil-rich kingdom is battling Houthi rebels. In early June, a UN report blasted the Saudi coalition in Yemen for 510 child deaths and 667 injuries, and placed the blame for 142 child deaths and 247 injuries on Houthi rebels. Both sides were condemned for attacks on schools and hospitals. Amnesty International decried blatant pandering, which it said damages the credibility of the UN as a whole. Oxfam said the world body's decision to retract its findings was a moral failure. For years, the Houthis, the Yemen government, and pro-government militias have been on the blacklist for violating children's rights. But a move to add Saudi Arabia to the blacklist created a huge backlash as Saudi leaders and their allies mounted a successful pressure campaign on UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. The British government stated it's investigating allegations that UK-manufactured cluster bombs have been used in Saudi attacks. Oxfam said the UN report was yet more evidence that countries such as Britain and the US should halt reckless arms sales to all participants in the conflict. During President Barack Obama's 7.5 years in office, the U.S. has deported roughly 2.5 million people, a record. That's a 23% increase over the previous George W. Bush administration. Despite a stated priority to largely focus on criminals, the government cast a wide net starting in 2008. According to Alejandra Castaneda, coordinator for the Observatory on Immigration Legislation and Policies at the College of the Northern Border in Tijuana, Mexico, the U.S. border enforcement focus wasn't just on people near the border or people trying to cross, but undocumented immigrants in the interior of the U.S. who may have had years or decades of living there, established lives with children and no criminal record. The mass deportations have created a trail of separated families, with U.S. resident children, or so-called Dreamers, protected from deportation by the Obama administration's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, living without one or both parents. According to the Christian Science Monitor, between 740,000 and 925,000 parents of U.S. resident children have been deported, mostly to Mexico and Central America, between 2003 and 2013. The city of Portland, Maine, raised their minimum wage to $10.10 an hour in January, boosting the pay of low-income workers. However, the state of Maine's minimum wage remains at $7.50. When Portland first moved to increase their municipal minimum wage in 2014, $10.10 an hour was a big deal. But in the last 2 years, states including New York and California have adopted a $15 an hour minimum wage. In 2017, Portland's minimum wage rises to $10.68. Subsequent increases will be indexed to inflation. Economists point out that a lack of indexing is why the federal minimum wage is so low. Its peak in terms of purchasing power nationally was in 1968. Maine's voters will cast ballots in November to decide whether or not to raise the state minimum wage to $12 an hour by 2020, which is when it would begin to be indexed to the state's Consumer Price Index. A coalition of business groups allied with Maine's unpopular conservative Tea Party governor, Paul LePage, has lobbied lawmakers to introduce an alternative proposal for a phased-in $10 minimum wage minus automatic indexing. But advocates say higher wages alleviate poverty for workers trapped in low-paid sectors and boost morale and reduce staff turnover, saving employers money. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
In the aftermath of the mass murder of 49 and injuries to more than 50 others, At an Orlando, Florida LGBTQ nightclub, the U.S. is again debating the need for stronger gun regulations. The worst mass shooting incident in U.S. history motivated Connecticut Democratic U.S. Senator Chris Murphy to launch a 15-hour filibuster that succeeded in scheduling a vote on several key gun control measures on June 20th. But like so many times before, Republicans backed by the NRA voted to block the most effective legislative proposals designed to make the nation's background check system more comprehensive and prevent individuals on the government's terrorist watch list from purchasing firearms. Despite overwhelming support for these bills, GOP politicians and a handful of conservative Democrats continue to oppose virtually all initiatives to reduce gun violence. A recent poll conducted by CNN ORC found 92% of Americans say they want expanded background checks, while 85% say they favor banning people on federal watch lists from buying firearms. The deadly epidemic of 30,000 gun-related murders and suicides that occur each year in the U.S. are among the highest per capita in the world. Your reporter spoke with Ladd Everett, Director of Communications with the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, who talks about the slow but steady progress he sees in mounting public pressure on Congress to enact basic gun safety regulations.
I think we've always known, even going into this vote, that there's going to have to be, I guess, what you would call some regime change in Congress before we can really move forward aggressively with reform. But I'm very confident that we're going to do that. One really, really important thing that's come out of all this is we are going to get the full buy-in of the LGBTQ movement moving forward on gun violence prevention measures. Many people might have seen George Takei's great piece in the Daily Beast the other night, where he was full-throatedly arguing for LGBTQ involvement in this issue. That's going to make a humongous difference from us. And you can only imagine, I mean, there's a lot of people, undoubtedly, probably mostly in Orlando and Florida, who are really aggravated that we couldn't even do something simple like prohibiting suspected terrorists like the Orlando shooter from buying guns. So I think this is going to come back to bite them in a big way, and I am very confident at this point, moving into November, that many of these politicians are going to pay a price. When Kelly Ayotte spoke on the floor today before the votes, she looked pale as a ghost and was clearly nervous. She was trying to lay out a case for why she was going to vote the way she's going to vote, but she knows she is going to take a beating on this in New Hampshire when she's up in November. So, you know, this is a long game. This is not a short game. For those who lack patience or lack a sense of history of how change comes in this country, you're probably going to be pretty frustrated. But I feel very good about where we are after this terrible shooting. There was real movement, even in the Republican ranks, particularly with the way Donald Trump responded about the terrorist watch list issue. He moved the NRA on the issue. Republicans are clearly more skittish than they've ever been. You could see that by the mere fact that they were willing to allow votes so quickly. But I think, you know, their hope now obviously will be, you know, we're getting pounded with calls now. Let's have these votes. Hopefully it'll die off. I think what they're going to find out is it's not going to die off, is that we are going to stay red hot going up until November, and then there's going to be some very contested races, and I think this issue will play a huge role in them.
Ladd, I wanted to ask you about Maine Republican Senator Susan Collins and a compromise proposal that she was talking about late last week that included using the no-fly list as opposed to the terrorist watch list to prohibit sales of firearms to those individuals. What do you make of her proposal as a compromise? Is it credible?
I think it is credible, yeah. It'll be very interesting to see where this goes from here. For those who, you know, just think as a knee-jerk that we've had our votes and we're not going to get any more votes, I wouldn't be so quick to say that right now. It's possible that Senator Collins and Senator Heitkamp, who was working with her on those compromise measures, could step forward and keep developing their proposal, and we could have an additional vote on that measure. But I appreciate Senator Collins and Senator Heitkamp working on that. I will say that Senator Heitkamp's two no votes on the good bills today were very disappointing, and I think that's going to cost her dearly. But that said, I think that's going to be a motivation for her to want to continue to work on that compromise and maybe get a vote on it. So, you know, we'll see how this plays out, but it would not surprise me in the least if, unlike Newtown, this vote is the beginning of a process as opposed to the end of a process.
So many politicians who are voting with the National Rifle Association and getting their money for their campaign contributions have for years appeared to be insulated against public accountability for their votes in Congress that go against public opinion. But has it really come down to gerrymandered districts? It's just hard to imagine why these folks continue to be so insulated from any kind of accountability.
Yeah, you know, but, you know, I don't think that's a permanent feature of our politics. You know, it's not as if Democrats can't retake these chambers of Congress. You know, the Senate is certainly in play, very much in play in November. And I think a lot of people now feel that the House is as well. Republicans have a presidential candidate who probably unstable is a good way to describe him, where, you know, who knows what's going to happen between now and November that could affect voting down ticket from the president. And long term, looking forward, the demographic and cultural changes in this nation do not favor Republicans, and they certainly don't favor a radical Republican Party. So look, I think the Republicans are trying to milk this reactionary wave as much as they can of, certain white Americans who feel downtrodden or feel like they're losing their privilege in society. But again, I don't think that's a long-term strategy for organizing. I think it has some short-term benefits, but I think long-term it's a failed strategy that's not going to work.
That was Ladd Everett, Director of Communications with the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Learn more about the campaign to enact common sense gun regulations by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After the carnage at Orlando's Pulse nightclub that killed 49 and wounded 53 on June 12th, Americans are reflecting on many issues related to the bloodbath there. Issues being debated include the threat of terrorism, religious extremism, gun control, and hate crimes targeting the LGBTQ community. While the motivation of the Orlando mass murderer may never be fully known, given the contradictory statements and behavior of the perpetrator, the targeting of gays and lesbians for violence is a familiar fact of life in the U.S. According to the most recent FBI statistics available, more than 20% of hate crimes reported nationally in 2014 targeted people based on their sexual orientation or gender identity. However, advocacy groups say these numbers dramatically undercount incidents involving the LGBTQ community, as they are based on local non-mandatory reporting. Further, statistics on murders and crimes against transgender people are especially unreliable, as many attacks are miscategorized or go unreported. The serious problem of homophobia can be seen in the statements made by several conservative Christian churches across the U.S. after the Orlando mass shooting, which praised the murders of gays and lesbians there. One pastor in Sacramento, California, lamented that more didn't die. Your reporter spoke with Sarah Warbelow, legal director with the group Human Rights Campaign. Here she discusses the tragic mass shooting in Orlando in the context of the ongoing epidemic of hate crimes targeting members of the LGBTQ community across the U.S.
First and foremost, you know, we really do want to remind Americans that it was the LGBTQ community that was targeted. This was not a random act of violence. The perpetrator, though we may never know his exact motives, made it clear that he was staking out and seeking LGBTQ people as the victim of his crime. And so we want to continue to educate the American public about the harms that occur when we have Americans who spew hate towards the LGBT community. And sometimes that hate is very much at the forefront and the focus. There are clear messages that LGBT people are sinners who are not deserving of the full American dream. But it's also those more than 200 pieces of legislation that have been introduced in more than 30 states across the country designed to undermine the rights of LGBTQ people. When we send messages of intolerance and hate, it's hardly surprising that someone who was predisposed to violence would select the LGBT community as the target of a hateful attack. So we're really committed to changing the rhetoric and the policies that are being introduced in legislatures from coast to coast. The second thing we're doing is we're really focusing on hate crimes against LGBTQ people. Currently, 20% of all hate crimes are motivated by the victim's sexual orientation or gender identity, according to the latest hate crime statistics collected by the FBI. That's a huge number, second only to hate crimes committed on the basis of race. And when you consider the relatively small number of people that are LGBTQ in this community, we're talking about a disproportionate level of violence against the LGBT community. And then finally, you know, in an area that has been relatively new for the human rights campaign, we are taking on the issue of gun violence protection. We know that the vast majority of Americans support solutions that are a common sense balance between the needs and rights under the Second Amendment and coming up with solutions that decrease the level of violence nationwide.
Sarah, what kind of hate crimes are committed across this country that don't get a great deal of attention from our news media, unlike this horrendous massacre of 49 people in Orlando, Florida?
In 2015, there were a very significant number of transgender women who were murdered in this country. These were individual murders, so rather than an instance of mass violence. But added up, we saw over 20 women who had their lives ended simply because the perpetrator of the violence could not tolerate that they were living their lives with an understanding of who they were, that their gender identity didn't match the sex assigned to them at birth, didn't correspond with who they understood themselves to be, and for their courage in living out their truth, their lives were horrendously ended. And I want to note, too, that many of these hate crimes are committed against people of color. Virtually all of those trans women who were murdered last year were women of color. And if we look at the incident that happened in Orlando, the vast majority of the individuals who were murdered were Latino or Latina.
In the aftermath of the Orlando massacre, we heard from conservative politicians, including the presumptive GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump and some other right-wing commentators, that they're now reaching out to the gay community, making the case that they are allies and can protect the community from hate crimes, including that emanating from religious extremists in the Islamic community. What do you make of that?
Sadly, I think that many of these politicians are being opportunistic. They're utilizing an incredibly tragic event to meet their own political goals. These are politicians who supposedly are offering an olive branch to the LGBT community, but have supported nominating justices to the Supreme Court that would undermine marriage equality, who have supported the so-called First Amendment Defense Act, which would allow for rampant discrimination against LGBTQ people by government actors and recipients of government funds. These are individuals who will not take a stand in support of ensuring that our civil rights laws provide the full protections needed for LGBTQ people in housing, public accommodations, even in jury service. So to think that all of a sudden they are the individuals who will be the saviors of the LGBT community is really just despicable.
That was Sarah Warbelow,
legal director with Human Rights Campaign. Find more information on how the LGBTQ community is combating hate crimes by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In addition to the infamous terrorist attacks in the U.S. on September 11, 2001, another September 11th in 1973 is a day that will live in infamy. That was the day that Chilean General Augusto Pinochet overthrew the government of Socialist President Salvador Allende. Allende, in his short time in office, had greatly improved the lives of Chile's poor and provided hope for a more equal society. Chilean singer-songwriter Victor Jara was the best-known popularizer of his nation's politics of hope and social justice. Beloved in his own country, he was well-known around the Americas for his beautiful songs that captured Chile's spirit of optimism during that era. Jara was one of thousands of Chileans rounded up after the U.S.-supported military coup and held prisoner in the National Stadium in Santiago. He was later tortured and shot to death. His body was later found with 44 bullet wounds. A civil lawsuit against former Chilean military officer Pedro Pablo Barrientos Núñez for the murder of Victor Jara is now moving forward in an Orlando, Florida court. Barrientos came to the U.S. in 1989 and is a U.S. citizen through marriage. The case, brought under the Alien Tort Statute and Torture Victim Protection Act, marks the first time an officer from the Chilean army will appear as a defendant in a U.S. courtroom to account for Jara's death. The complaint seeks unspecified damages for torture and extrajudicial killing. A parallel case filed in Chile has been moving very slowly through the court system there. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Dixon Osborne, executive director of the Center for Justice and Accountability, the group which filed the suit against Barrientos in September 2013, on behalf of the Jara family. Here he talks about why the case is being pursued in the U.S. and the best outcome for the plaintiffs and justice.
Joan Jara, the widow of Victor Jara, has been pursuing justice for the torture and murder of her husband for 43 years. The reason has filed a civil lawsuit in the United States and why that trial is happening right now is because the person responsible for her husband's torture and murder has been living in the United States for the last 20 years. The civil statutes in the United States that allows individuals to pursue civil liability for people who've engaged in torture and extrajudicial killing. So the person living here is former lieutenant under Pinochet, Pedro Pablo Núñez Barrientos, and that is the civil trial that's going on now. She has tried to file claims in Chile. While Pinochet remained in power, those claims were barred. Now that he's no longer in power, the investigation has taken a long time and nothing has moved yet to trial. So the significance of the case in Orlando right now is that this is the first trial to try to hold somebody accountable for the torture and murder of Victor Jara.
What do you have to prove to show that Barrientos is liable for the death of Victor Jara?
We're proving two different things. One is that Barrientos is the trigger man. He's the one who actually shot Victor Jara, that killed him, and that he tortured him before that. In the alternative, and at the very least, Barrientos aided and abetted in the torture and murder of Victor Jara. In this civil trial, what we have to show is that it is more likely than not that Barrientos did do what we claim he has done.
Dixon Osborne, just the fact that Barrientos was in charge of what was going on in the stadium, could that fact alone be enough to convict him of these charges?
The level of responsibility, the duties that he had in the stadium, certainly point to a conclusion. We think that he was responsible for the torture and murder of Victor Jara. You have one of the conscripts who testified this week who said that Barrientos is the one who was in charge. You have another conscript saying that he was carrying official orders. back and forth between the stadium and the military command center. He clearly exercised, you know, significant control and responsibility for the events that took place at Chile Stadium, which is where the Pinochet regime took prisoners in the immediate aftermath of the coup.
What would be the best outcome for the plaintiffs in this case?
Well, the outcome that we're looking for in this case is for a jury of peers to determine that Barrientos is liable for the torture and murder of Victor Jara. Not only does that finally bring resolution and accountability to this case that's been lingering for 43 years, but more importantly, I think it speaks to the people of Chile who have been looking for accountability in this case. Victor Jara is perhaps the most symbolic murder that occurred under the Pinochet regime, because Victor Jara was such an iconic figure there. For the listeners who don't know Victor Jara, he was an iconic folk singer who has inspired people from Bono to Joan Baez.
Is there a possibility he could be extradited back to Chile, or is that not possible, or don't you even care about that?
Yeah, in terms of the civil case, what we're looking for right now and are really focused on is this case. Now, what happens after that is going to be up to the government of Chile and the government of the United States. So it's hard to predict.
That was Dixon Osborne, executive director of the Center for Justice and Accountability, which seeks justice for human rights violations across Latin America. For more information on the Victor Jara case and the center's work, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jabal's radio essay.
Gloria Cheeks, 1938, 2016. Her name was Gloria, and if you knew her, you knew she was a special woman. She was a woman who didn't bite her tongue. If she dug you, you knew it. If she didn't, you knew that, too. When she smiled, it was like the rising sun, glorious. But if you crossed her, storm clouds gathered, and thunder would sound from the heavens. She was a mother, a grandmother, a great-grandmother, and a great-great-grandmother of Stephanie, Tracy, Marvis, and Tahira, Anthony, Isaiah, Hadiya, Komara, Tainetta, Ta'a, Taihimba, Taraji, and Tara. There are at least 20 great-grands and a great-great-grandchild, Messiah. She was also a MOVE supporter, as real as rain. On May 13, 1985, when the state waged war against MOVE, the first instinct of Gloria Cheeks was to run toward a burning MOVE house. Only gunfire from a police sniper slowed her run. Gloria Perlot Cheeks was a woman of glorious dimples, a deep infectious laugh, and deeper abiding loves of her family of her friends, and of her people. After 78 summers, she returns to the ancestors. The memory of Gloria will linger long in the memory of many. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Good night, sister. Major battles on. For over 31 years, Major Tillery has been a prisoner of the state. Despite that extraordinary fact, he continues his battles, both in the prison for his health and in the courts for his freedom. Several weeks ago, Tillery filed a direct challenge to his criminal conviction by claiming that a so-called secret witness was, in fact, a paid police informant who was given a get-out-of-jail-free card if he testified against Tillery. Remember I mentioned paid? Well, this witness was paid, but not in dollars. He was paid in sex. In the spring of 1984, Robert Mickens was facing decades in prison on rape and robbery charges. After he testified against Tillery, however, his 25-year sentence became 5 years probation. And before he testified, he was given an hour-and-a-half visit, a private visit, with his girlfriend at the offices of the Homicide Squad, the old Philadelphia police roundhouse. To a prisoner, some things are more important than money, like sex, for example. In a verified document written in April 2016, Mickens declares that he lied at trial after being coached by the DAs on the case and detectives. He lied to get out of jail and because he could get with his girl. Other men have done more for less. Major's 58-page petition is a time machine into a practice that was once common in Philadelphia. Way back in the 1980s and 90s, the police roundhouse had become a whorehouse. Major, facing major health issues from his hepatitis C infection, stubborn skin rashes, and serious intestinal disorders, is still battling. And the fight ain't over. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Determining Britain's exit from the 28-nation body called the European Union, EU, dubbed Brexit by the hip British press, has sent shockwaves around the world. That it has done so is a reflection of how narrow the national and global media is, and how little they see of the world they purport to cover. It is also a window into a world of rising right-wing nationalism, and a walk away from the very notion of globalism. The EU, which began as the EC, European Community, was a centuries-long trend to unify Europe as a singular global force, a kind of United States of Europe. While that notion still has force, to have one of its biggest members vote to leave means that unifying force is weakening. That's largely because the EU served its economic elites first and best and left working class and poor people to fend for themselves. The Brexit vote demonstrates that older working class Brits yearn for British hegemony, the old days of empire, and not to be submerged in a bland European stew. Other nations now are considering whether the grass really is greener on the other side. The media used polls and pundits to predict the upcoming vote, and their projections strongly lean towards British rejection of the Brexit option. Unheard were the voices of the elderly, the rural, the poor, the working classes. Unheard and unseen, they became the voters for rejection of a globalist project and a return to a more hopeful time. They provided this immense shock to the system. The globalist notion, so long seen as inevitable, has been given a big punch in the nose. Let's see if other punches are coming. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
What were the main instruments used to undermine the sovereign will of the Canadian people? Who is taking control of the planet, and how are they doing it? How has the U.S. managed to undermine Canadians' control over military and foreign policy? How did the Bank of Canada's decision to embrace monetarism in the Trudeau era result in hundreds of billions of dollars being directed to private banks? What is in the Trans-Pacific Partnership currently under negotiation that would jeopardize what is left of Canadian democracy? On this week's Global Research News Hour, as we near the end of our broadcast season, we spend the hour discussing how the people's power has been usurped by a small cabal of world elites, with a prominent veteran Canadian politician and former cabinet minister, Paul Hellyer. On this week's program, Overthrowing the Secret Government, a conversation with the Honorable Paul Hellyer. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of June 24th, 2016. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Wall Street understands that the defeat of Brexit means a shortened lifespan for London as a financial center, as it is impossible to be a financial center unless a country has its own currency and central bank. As it is impossible for the UK to be a member of the EU and not operate under the European Central Bank, once the Brexit referendum is defeated, the process of gradually forcing the UK into the euro will begin. The other powerful interest is the interest of Washington to prevent one country's exit from leading to the exit of other countries. As CIA documents found in the U.S. National Archives make clear, the EU was a CIA initiative, the purpose of which is to make it easy for Washington to exercise political control over Europe. It is much easier for Washington to control the EU than 28 separate countries. That comes from the article, Brexit, What Is It About? What Is At Stake? By Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, posted June 22nd, originally appearing at paulcraigroberts.org. Writing in the Financial Times, British lawyer David Alan Green explained Brexit voting is advisory, not mandatory. Parliament has final say. MPs can legally disregard the public's will either way. They alone empowered to decide the path Britain chooses. What happens ahead is, quote, a matter of politics, not law. It will come down to what is politically expedient and practical, unquote, said Green. That comes from the article, Brexit referendum is non-binding. UK Parliament, not voters, has final say, by Stephen Lendman, posted June 23rd. While the Brexit debate has become a matter of colliding blocks of speculators and crystal ball gazers, a glaring aspect has come to the fore. Virtually nothing has been said about the role played by human rights, Britain's role in building it up, and inspiration in the European Convention of Human Rights, or the issue about citizenship. In that sense, Brexit mirrors broader European failures, the excision of the human experience from broader managerial and corporate arguments. In its stead is a reflection about what the price of Camembert cheese might be in a post-Brexit regime, or wine for that matter. This is middle-class snobbery run wild, a fear born from comfort rather than crisis. That comes from the article, The Inhumanity of Brexit, by Dr. Binoy Campmark, posted June 23rd. The economics is clear. There is no need to be a member of the EU to thrive economically, and exiting does not have to impact UK economic growth at all. The UK can remain in the European economic era, as Norway has done, or simply agree on a trade deal, as Switzerland did, and enjoy free trade, the main intention of European agreements in the eyes of the public. The politics is also clear. The European superstate that has already been formed is not democratic. The so-called European Parliament, unique among parliaments, cannot propose any legislation at all. Laws are all formulated and proposed by the unelected European Commission. As a Russian observer has commented, the European Parliament is a rubber-stamping sham, just like the Soviet Parliament during the days of the Soviet Union, while the unelected government is the European Commission, the Politburo replete with its commissars. That comes from the article EU Basics, Your Guide to the UK Brexit Referendum on EU Membership by Professor Richard A. Werner, posted June 22nd, originally appearing on his blog, professorwerner.wordpress.com. When one thinks of lines of people waiting patiently to obtain hard currency, one may think Russia, as was the case in December 2014 when the currency was plunging. And yet, as the FT shows in what may be the first of many such stunning images, quote, long queues stretched outside foreign exchange bureaus in the City of London on Thursday as people cashed in their pounds ahead of the EU referendum, unquote. Some just want some vacation money, but it's safe to say that the vast majority of those lining up have far more existential concerns. Whether or not these are validated will be revealed as soon as the FX markets open for trading after the Brexit vote is released. That comes from the article, Brits Dump Pound Sterling Ahead of Brexit Vote. Long queues outside foreign exchange bureaus by Tyler Durden, posted June 23rd, originally appearing at Zero Hedge. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Paul Hellyer is a Canadian engineer, politician, writer, and commentator who's had a long and varied career. He's the longest-serving current member of the Privy Council of Canada, just ahead of Prince Philip. He was first elected as a Liberal in 1949 in the federal election in the riding of Davenport, and he was the youngest person ever elected to that point in the Canadian House of Commons. He has served in cabinet under three different prime ministers, namely Louis Saint-Laurent, Lester Pearson, and Pierre Trudeau. He served as Minister of National Defense under Lester Pearson and as Minister of Transport under Pierre Trudeau. He then chaired a task force on housing and urban renewal and resigned from cabinet and from the Liberal caucus in 1969 following a dispute with Trudeau over housing policy. He formed the Canadian Action Party in 1997 as a parliamentary option for Canadians seeking withdrawal from the free trade agreements and corporate globalization, and has continued to write a number of books, including One Big Party to Keep Canada Independent, Goodbye Canada, and his most recent, The Money Mafia, A World in Crisis. Thank you very much for joining us, Mr. Hellyer.
It's a pleasure.
Now, I just wanted to draw your attention, first of all, there's a writer and commentary I'm sure you're familiar with named Peter Dale Scott, who's talked about something called the deep state. And as I understand it, this has to do with powerful elites who are able to direct the affairs of a nation without the democratic consent of the people, and in some cases can effectively veto decisions made by legislators acting on the direction of the people. When did you first get the sense of something like a deep state in Canada, that there's someone other than elected legislators running the show? Is that something you can dredge up?
I think it really started with the Canada-U.S. Free Trade Agreement. Mm-hmm. And when I did what most people haven't done. I actually read it. And, of course, as you would understand, it's not a free trade agreement at all. It's an investment agreement. It was to take away from Canada the right to veto the purchase of Canadian companies by American and other international investors. And also, it introduced a concept that is one of the worst in the world, in my opinion, and that is called the dispute settlement mechanism, whereby if Canada or one province or somebody in Canada passes a law which affects the profits or potential profits, which is worse, of a foreign investor, then they can sue us for damages. So, in effect, we have this dark shadow over us all the time that you can't do something that you think is in the interest of the people because you're likely to get sued. And I think there was a recent case of Quebec wanting to stop fracking. And I think it was an American company decided that they would sue the Canadian government as a result of that. And we have been sued, I think, more times than anybody else so far under the NAFTA, which is the sort of continuation of the Canada-U.S. Free Trade Agreement. And then, of course, this is all moving to other free trade agreements, the Canada-European Free Trade Agreement, which I hope will not occur now that Britain has decided to go it alone. But my view would be very different from the people in Ottawa, where the civil service is largely composed of what we call neoliberals. I don't know why they're called liberals, but they're people who have accepted the sort of post-war idea of a world without borders. And one of my lines in one of the books, I can't remember whether it was my second last, Light at the End of the Tunnel, Survival Plan for the Human Species, or the one that you mentioned, the Money Mafia. But a world without borders is like a zoo without cages, where only the most powerful will survive. And that's exactly, of course, what's going on. And that's exactly the way it was planned by this supranational group, which is really running the United States for sure, and has been since World War II pretty well, and has reduced presidents to a little more than talking heads, and reduced Congress to a bunch of squabbling partisans who really don't know what is going on in the world. And so we find ourselves in a very strange atmosphere at the moment, where there are things going on that most people just don't know about. They have no comprehension of what is really going on in the world and has been for the last few decades. And this is a blanket right over our lives, our futures, the way we live, and it's really a terrible situation as far as I'm concerned. And the people are so naive. I was a member of a panel 4 years ago in Washington, where we were discussing what was really going on in the cosmos, and we had six former congressmen there, and I was almost shell-shocked by the fact that they had no idea what the real government of the United States, and I say the real government, not the government that pretends to be the government, but the real government, which is called the shadow government, or the alternative government, they had no idea what they were doing and how they were in control, how they gained control, and what the plans were for the United States and for the world, which in effect is a new world order, as they call it. And what they mean by that is a non-elected world government for, by, and of them.
Mr.
In other words, the end of democracy and the establishment of a fascist state, world state that they would dominate. So this is just, you know, that is the situation at the moment, and most people are unaware of it and how it happened and who's involved in it and how we allowed it to happen.
Mr. Hellyer, you mentioned the free trade agreements and these economic arrangements as essentially, you sort of paraphrase, a kind of a Trojan horse, because it had that dispute settlement mechanism incorporated into it. And yet, you know, all of our politicians tend to think of it as just, you know, getting rid of tariffs and just opening us up to free trade. I'm wondering if there aren't other ways in which, you know, the sovereignty of Canadians is being undermined. And I'm particularly thinking in terms of military integration, because I welcome your thoughts, particularly as somebody who was once Minister of National Defense, about how our sovereign authority to on foreign policy or going to war or military incursions or whatever, how that's been undermined over the last 50 years.
It's been underlined mostly in the last few years. Since George W. Bush, knowing that the towers were going to be attacked, did nothing to stop it and let 9/11 happen. And then pretended that it was an attack on the United States and declared NATO to come to the rescue of the United States. Literally, this is one of the major tragedies of my life, to see this happen, because NATO, which was a really great organization back in my day in office and for years after that, was a defensive organization. It was to protect European countries largely if they were attacked by someone. And for all of the NATO members to then say, we will come to the rescue of whoever happened to be. But by that simple act of deception, really, NATO has been transferred into something like a U.S. task force to do its bidding. And we, unfortunately, have just gone along with it as if it was all legitimate and as if it was real. And we have been dragged into situations in the Middle East that were, you know, in effect, deliberate American policy, because they had a document, a plan for a new American century, it was called. That was the sort of the vernacular, and it was deliberately designed to go along with the plans for this new world government, new world order, and we were just taken in by an action that was taken to facilitate the plan for a new American empire. This goes way back to 1940, when the Council on Foreign Relations in the United States decided that Hitler was going to lose and that they should start working on a new empire that would encompass not only the empire that Hitler envisaged, but also a much larger one, all of North America and Great Britain and much of Southeast Asia, Australia, New Zealand, and so on. And they've been working on it ever since. And they sort of, as they went along, and they've been at it since 1940, they have recruited two other organizations, the Bilderbergers, who are the most secret organization in the world, and as of the moment, the most powerful. And then the Trilateral Commission, which is the third one, but which is the most open. I call them the Three Sisters, but they are sort of at the top of what, in my both books, Light at the End of the Tunnel and the Money Mafia, I refer to as the Cabal. And the Cabal today consists of the banking cartel at the top of the apex. It's the sort of brain center for the whole thing. And then below that, the oil cartel, and then the transnational corporations that are controlled by the banks, and then intelligence agencies, many of them, but the major ones, the CIA, the FBI, the NSA, and then a couple of foreign ones too, the British MI6 and the Israeli Mossad are involved in it, and then a huge swath of the United States military. And they are what we call, what I call anyway, and other, lots of other people do too, the cabal. And they have been running the United States for decades and still are, and much of the rest of the world, including ourselves and the monetary field and so on. And they have been systematically transferring power away from nation states into their own hands. And this was very deliberate. It was a policy that was partly, I guess, designed by David Rockefeller. And I have no fear in using his name, and I use it. That's the only one I mentioned in my latest book, because he has written that he thinks that the world would be better run by, quote, bankers and elites than by the present, democratic auto-determination system. So that was his goal, and he's a long way along the road toward it. And most of the people in the United States and nearly everybody in Canada hasn't a clue as to what's been going on and to what the plan is and to how they can do anything to counteract it.
Now, I just going back to military, I mean, you mentioned the significance of 9/11 and framed it as I think the term is false flag. And for what it's worth, I agree with you there. But I mean, it seems to me that 9/11 was more a matter of boosting something that was already an integration that was already happening. We saw with like the Avro Arrow, for example. I mean, that was something that was, it would have been a very effective.
It would have been very effective, but it was like most of Canadian inventions that are ahead of their time. We get them to the just about to the point of perfection, and then drop them.
Yeah, I'm also thinking that with our involvement in NORAD and other sorts of instruments of integration north south. That maybe our involvement in the 91 Iraq war and the invasion of NATO's assault on Yugoslavia in 99, that these were not necessarily sovereign Canadian decisions, that there was a significant amount of influence on Canada to participate.
Well, there's a lot of pressure. The Americans put on pressure for whatever they want. And I know that from going back to the Vietnam War. Robert McNamara kept saying, you fellows should join us. And I said, thanks, but no thanks, because I knew that was the position of our Prime Minister, Lester Pearson. And then they keep, and it's interesting now, when they have expanded NATO into Eastern Europe and so on, they want the people over there to pick up a larger proportion of the load by buying more weapons. Well, where did they buy the weapons? In the United States. And so this rebounds to the advantage of what General Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex. And the military-industrial complex, of course, is just almost another word for the cabal. It's all part of the same thing, and has the same winners that the big corporations controlled by the big banks benefit from every new war that they can start. And the U.S. has had a policy of continuous war since World War II. First the Cold War and then the war on the Middle East and fighting all across that broad spectrum of dissent. And then, according to Dr. Wernher von Braun, the third thing will be using the extraterrestrial threat, they will call it, for another excuse to spend more money on arms and less money on trying to save the planet and trying to save its people. I mean, all of they spend trillions of dollars on arms while people are starving to death. And this is the kind of the sense of imbalance, I would say immorality, that you have at the present time. And we have a crisis on global warming, and they're really not doing anything about it. They're playing a game of saying, you know, in 20 or 30 years we have to reduce emissions to levels that are reasonable. But this is an urgent thing, and in my latest book, I say that we've got 7 years to do something about it, and even then, it may be too late, but we could stop a lot of the damage if we made it a high priority, which it isn't. We're doing everything else, including fighting these wars on terrorism, which were all part of the plan for the new American century. It was all the plans for attacking Iraq were all laid out in that document, and it's all on the record. And I recount that in, I guess, one or two of my books anyway. And so we're being taken along by the nose, and heaven only knows what and when some fruition will be for this sort of thing. And coming now back to what happened in England, it is possible that this reassertion of national sovereignty may slow the process down. I don't know. But if that were to be the case, then it would be perhaps a blessing in disguise. So we'll have to wait and see what happens over there and whether it turns out to be a good thing or a bad thing.
I'm just going to take this opportunity to acknowledge and thank some of our affiliates. CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo, BC, airs the show Thursdays at 1 p.m. Pacific Time. Boston College Radio, WZBC, 90.3 FM Newtons, during the Truth and Justice radio programming slot Sundays at 7 a.m. Eastern Time. Port Perry Radio in Port Perry, Ontario, airs the show Thursdays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Burnaby Radio Station, CJSF, out of Simon Fraser University, airs the show every Saturday at 6 a.m. at 90.1 FM to most of Greater Vancouver, and also on 93.9 FM cable in the communities of Simon Fraser University, Burnaby, and beyond. Radio station CFUV 101.9 FM, based at the University of Victoria, airs the Global Research News Hour every Sunday from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. Cortez Community Radio, CKTZ 89.5 out of Manson's Landing, BC, airs the show Tuesday mornings at 10 a.m. Pacific Time. Cowichan Valley Community Radio, CICV 98.7 FM, serving the Cowichan Lake area of Vancouver Island, BC, airs the program Thursdays at 6 a.m. Pacific Time. Campus and Community Radio Station CFMH 107.3 FM in St. John airs the Global Research News Hour Fridays at 10 a.m. And we encourage our listeners to support these and other independent outlets who help make independent news and views heard. Coming up after this brief pause, we'll hear more from Paul Hellyer. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Okay, now, Mr. Hellyer, another very important theme of your work has been the issue of monetary policy and how the role of the central bank in Canada, which is a public asset, has been undermined since Trudeau's time. And that Bank of Canada played a very critical role in building up the country and building up the infrastructure of the country. And so the fact that now we're the fact that the Bank of Canada has effectively been undermined now, that is an important factor in terms of the will of the people being achieved. So I'm wondering if you could talk about how, or you know, why we eventually ended up breaking away from the Bank of Canada as our lender of choice, and exactly why it is that Justin Trudeau, the current Trudeau, who seems to understand the importance of borrowing at low rates of interest and the importance of financing infrastructure, why his government seems to be so, you know, obstinate or ignorant, I don't know which of it is, in terms of not returning to the Bank of Canada, the use of the Bank of Canada.
Yeah, this is a long story, but it just happens to be one of the most important ones facing the world today because of the major problems in the world. Global warming is the most important, but the financial system is the most urgent, because if you don't solve the financial system, then nation states don't have the financial flexibility for a fast changeover from fossil fuels to new forms of energy. So the money problem is really at the top of the list. And going back to the plan for world government and the cabal, as I say in my book, this is all planned. They decided that rather than take over all of these countries by force of arms, which is expensive and kills a lot of people, that they could do it by other means, such as monetary means and trade agreements. And that is the way they've been going, and they've been very, very successful. So as most of our listeners would not know, in 1939, well, first of all, 1938, there were no jobs in Canada. And then 1939, the war came along. Pretty soon, everyone was employed either in the armed forces or building munitions or building plants to make munitions or doing something. And we actually achieved a all-time low of 1% unemployment. I'm not recommending that now, but I would like to see the unemployment rate reduced by half at least, which would be easy to do if they would just take the steps that some of us are recommending. Well, you might ask, where did the government get the money to do all those things? And the answer was that the Bank of Canada printed it, P-R-I-N-T-E-D, and made it available to the government of Canada at near zero cost, just the cost of administration deducted.
That was part of the Bank of Canada Act.
Well, sure, it was covered by the Bank of Canada Act. And we had at that time the first and brightest, in my opinion, of the governors. And he developed a system that worked for the benefit of the people of Canada. And in effect, the money creation system, money creation was shared between the government of Canada and the private banks. And the system worked well because the money that the Bank of Canada created for the federal government was spent into circulation. It wound up in the private banks where it became what the economists called high-powered money. And then that was the money that the banks could use to multiply, to provide credit for building factories and for doing other things and expanding the money supply and getting the economy moving at a real fast pace. Well, this system worked beautifully to get us out of the Depression, to help finance the war, but then we also used it in the post-war period to build infrastructure, including the St. Lawrence Seaway and the Trans-Canada Highway and the great new airport terminals and so on. And something that most of your listeners wouldn't remember was the Dew Line. This was a distant early warning system of radar stations right around the periphery of Canada to warn us the approach of Soviet bombers. And it was very expensive. And we did all of those things. And and at the same time launched a very, very good Social Security system without having to borrow very much at all, virtually no borrowing. And so the system worked like a charm for 35 years, the best 35 years of the 20th century, until 1974, when the Bank of Canada arbitrarily changed the rules. And there was no consultation with Mr. Trudeau Sr. There was no agreement by the Government of Canada. I'm not even sure that the governor himself knew what he was doing. But he made a speech out west saying he was adopting monetarism. And what he didn't say was that that means that we have decided to go along with the Bank for International Settlements in Zurich, Switzerland, and stop making cheap money available to our government. And that was part of the deal. I think they were seduced, but the most important point is that that was the cabal in action. That was the shadow government in action, that they managed to get the countries of the world to give up their sovereignty to create money for themselves, which is their right, because we, the people, own the patent to create money. We own it, not the private banks. But somehow this gang or whatever managed to get people like us to go along with a system where the rules were made in Zurich for the benefit of the richest, most powerful, most callous people in the world. And they were, in effect, imposing their will on the rest of us. And this was, talk about loss of sovereignty, this was the most important bit that's happened in my lifetime, and I've been around for quite a while. So we had to start borrowing in the market. And, of course, then Paul Volcker, when he was chairman of the Fed system, brought on that terrible recession in 81-82, and we were borrowing money for 21-22%. And at that rate, the debt from the deficit, because they at the same time tried to control inflation, cost-push inflation by crushing the economy, and revenues fell off, all expenses remained, and so we had deficits. And these were rolled over into debt, and then we had to borrow the money to pay the deficits and accumulate a substantial debt, which is now $615 billion. And if the present government continues with its present course, it will be $700 billion within 4 years. Well, the bottom line on all of this is that we have paid, we Canadian taxpayers, have paid $1,100,000,000 we didn't need to pay in interest from fiscal 1974-5 to fiscal 2010-11. And that's a lot of money. Any way you look at it, that's a lot of money, which was really the shortfall that we needed to do things for the First Nations, which we've been talking about and never doing anything about, and for health care and for education and for infrastructure and for the arts, right across the board. We have been underfunding for 45 years as a result of the imposition of an external control on our sovereignty in the area of money and banking.
Now, it's interesting you point that out, because so much of the messaging we've been getting from both of the main parties, federal parties, and actually most of the provincial parties, is that this huge debt grew with Trudeau because he spent too much, and that's what's to blame. That's what always comes up when you hear people talking about this huge debt problem, and we're hearing.
And it's a total myth. I'm not a defender of Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau, but at the same time, I know that that is not true, and I have to say so, because I got permission to look at his papers, and I went through them for 2 days and could find nothing. There was no indication that he had any idea what was being done. And I got in touch with John English, who was his official biographer, and asked him if in the course of his research for two biographical books, he had come across anything at all that indicated that there had been any discussions between the governor of the bank and the prime minister and or the government about changing the system of financing the federal government. And he said, absolutely none. So the Prime Minister of Canada did not know. The Cabinet did not know. Parliament did not know. It was all a unilateral decision on the part of a corporation, which we own.
So this is interesting that you sent over $1 trillion.
Over $1 trillion.
Over the course of the last 3 decades has been spent because of a decision that was not made by any parliamentarian.
Exactly.
but a simple position made by the Bank of Canada. That's quite fascinating and scary.
Yeah, it is. And I don't vouch for this mathematics, but one of my friends said that was $17,000 for every person in the country. But no matter, if you start looking at the real problems they're trying to solve today, what they need is probably $100 billion more a year to start undoing the damage that this austerity economics has done in the last few years.
Could you explain, you've put this out there, and I'm trying to understand what is stopping parliamentarians from even talking about it. In fact, there was even a CBC interview where I believe it was one of the CBC programs, Amanda Lang was interviewing Rocco Galati, who's currently championing the Comer case, which is against the Bank of Canada and the finance minister for abandoning its legislated role.
Right.
And yet it's not getting any attention. And I mean, are parliamentarians, do they understand these things? Are they just ignorant? Why? What would be motivating them from going back to the Bank of Canada?
I think they're ignorant in the dictionary sense of not having any comprehension of how the system works. They have no idea what money is. When I wrote my first book on money, called Funny Money, in 1994, I interviewed dozens and dozens of people, including the publisher of one Toronto paper, the executive editor of another national Toronto paper, and so on, and some financial writers. And there was not one of them that knew what money is and where it comes from. Not one. And so it's really ignorance in sort of the dictionary sense. And that, you know, that I can understand because it's not taught in the schools. But what I can't understand is why politicians, when you go to them and say there's a better way, there's a way out of this, there's a wonderful way out, we can get the economy up and running in no time flat if we go back to the system we had before 1974. In other words, if we learn from our own experience, we can solve our problems, and not every problem, but most problems that depend on the shortage of money. And they won't take an hour off to listen to you. That's what really gripes me. And so a bunch of us now we have launched a program to try and get the government to go back to that system, and we have sent them a plan which would involve the Bank of Canada accepting shares in Canada, non-convertible, non-transferable, non-redeemable shares in Canada for the issue of currency. And we're suggesting $150 billion a year for 7 years. And that $150 billion would be split 50-50 between the federal government and the provincial governments and territories on a per capita basis. which would be more than enough to stimulate the economy and to start making up the shortfall for these years of underfunding. And then at the end of 7 years, to split, to once again have a sharing between money creation between the government of Canada and the private banks, as we had before, where the government would get 34% of the new money created every year and the banks would get 66%. So it would be the government of Canada getting 34 instead of nothing and the banks getting 66% instead of 97. So we sent this to the government, and I don't know if they've even taken the time to read it, but there's been no debate. There's been nothing, no reports in the papers, and so we're just worrying away at it and holding meetings and making flyers to distribute. And if nothing happens, I'll probably do a coast-to-coast a tour in the fall and try and go to each of the provincial capitals and tell them what it would do for them. For example, Alberta had an $8 billion deficit. That would be their share under the plan. We call it a social contract between the government and people of Canada. And Ontario would get $38 billion, which would put them in a position to not only have money to spare, but enough to finance transportation and health care and all of the things that have been cut back and cut back and cut back again for the last 20 years, and get the economy going. But most important of all, to give young Canadians a chance to have meaningful jobs and to create and to do something worthwhile with their lives, which was, you know, just taken for granted back in my day. We just assumed that there was going to be something worthwhile for us to do. But now you have this more than a million young people in Canada who are unemployed, and it's been 9 years since the system crashed, and deliberately by the cabal, by the monetary cartel, so that they could make money by short selling and then by putting small banks out of business and taking over their assets and so on. And this is longer than the Great Depression.
Mr. Hellyer, sorry to interrupt, but I'm just saying that, like, I mean, you mentioned at the outset about ignorance, and yet there's been so little information. I mean, all of these, benefits that seem to be there, there's so little messaging about it. Even with the Bank of Canada, there was an action to strike, and it was it had been rejected. So that goes to show that this is not some trivial conspiracy theory. There's meat to it, and yet there's no mention of it in the mainstream media. So that's got to be more than ignorance. There's obviously some kind of a deliberate strategy to conceal this from the public.
The bottom line strategy is that the entire English language information system worldwide is controlled by a Bilderberger. Not the same one, but one. And in a new book by Daniel Estulin, he lists them all. And so it doesn't matter which television broadcasting system you go to or which newspaper chain you go to, they are all controlled by somebody with a Bilderberger background. In other words, this shadow government background. And consequently, the people are not getting the truth. They're not getting the truth about just about anything that's important. And consequently, the only information they get usually is disinformation. And they keep getting this idea, well, let's have another trade agreement, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, for example. And the Trans-Pacific Partnership, as I call it, is the coup de grace, in that they would take away what's remaining of our sovereignty, but most important, it would be a unilateral change in the Constitution of Canada, where the federal government now has total control over money and banking, and put us in the position where if our government did what we the dissenters, are recommending, they would be sued by foreign banks for billions, tens or hundreds of billions of dollars, and consequently they would be deterred from doing it. So that's the reason that we're taking such a very strong position against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, because it does nothing for the people. It does something, a lot, for the cabal and the rich elite and the people who already have all the money. And they're the winners, once more. And the 99% are the losers, once more. And so consequently, when you read in the papers that business says it would be a good thing to do, yes, it would for them, but not for the rest of us.
Well, I'm wondering then, I mean, are these trade agreements even legal? I mean, it sounds, I mean, I think you've used the term treason in describing how these agreements have undermined Canadian sovereignty. I mean, can they be addressed or confronted through legal means?
I don't know. I paid quite a bit of money to try and have get an injunction against CETA, the European Trade Agreement, and it was not. The motion was never made because at the time there wasn't enough information available about the actual text. But it hasn't been tested in the courts, and I guess that is the final recourse. But here again, if anybody takes them on for size, it's like an army and David with a slingshot, and the power of the state is used to crush the attempt to get the truth out. So it's not a one-sided contest. It's a power play to shut up anybody that has any ideas that are not in accordance with the so-called conventional wisdom at the time, and just to carry on with the status quo, which is neoliberalism, which is your one world without borders.
There is a constitutional requirement that these agreements have to be ratified by Parliament, right? They can't just be done by executive order or by cabinet.
I don't think that's written anywhere.
Okay. All right. Well,
that's sort of the practice that has been developed without anybody contesting it.
Okay, so you're saying that it's perfectly legal for a cabinet, be it conservative or liberal, to just without a vote in Parliament to enact these.
No, I do not. I think it's illegal as well as immoral.
Okay,
but no one has contested that in the courts, so this is just my opinion.
Okay,
that they're especially in this case that they would be unilaterally changing the Constitution. And that would be, in my opinion, illegal because they have to have provincial consent on the same formula that is there for changing the Constitution itself.
Okay, but that is a legal avenue that one could pursue because you don't have that provincial consent explicitly.
If you had a couple of million dollars that you could part with without trouble.
Okay. I wanted to get some comments in about Brexit. You were mentioning it earlier. It does appear that the United Kingdom has voted in favor of leaving, but that's not, as I understand, that's not binding. You know, so it's up to Parliament to decide based on that. I mean, they could be like Syriza in Greece and just kind of ignore what the people have said, but it does beg the question, what would the departure of the United Kingdom from the European Union, what would it mean for this Canada-European Union Comprehensive Economic Trade Agreement? What would it mean for the region at large?
Well, I hope it'll kill the agreement. There's no proof that that will happen. But I think Britain has been one of the proponents of the Canada-European Trade Agreement, one of the strongest ones, so I'm told. And it would be good to do without them on that side. But only time will tell. But I think what we have to come to terms with is that the British vote is a referendum on widespread dissatisfaction with the status quo. That's what it is. And it's the same thing as the Trump effect at the south of the border. People are getting fed up with the world being run by a small group of people who say that we're going to keep transferring jobs to other countries and reducing your wages, and if you don't take a reduction in wage, why, we'll just transfer the manufacturing facility to some other part of the world and you can stuff it. And that people are getting sick of that. Mm-hmm. And so this is sort of a general rebellion. We in Canada haven't quite reached that stage of activity yet, or of opposition. Although, if we looked at it, you know, in the broad context, as a result of the trade agreements, we have lost all of our major transnational corporations, the biggest ones, just a few, you know, Alcan and International Nickel, and Stelco, McMillan Bloedel, and Algoma Steel, and it goes on and on. And the middle class has been crushed since we started getting into these trade agreements. Mm-hmm. And so you have to ask yourself, is that the way to go? And I would say no. Free trade is good, or good, I would say fair trade is good, and the free trade over the long run, but not imposed overnight and losing all the jobs and demolishing the middle class. But then we've got to have enough sovereignty to create domestic demand, which is 10 times more important than any of the trade agreements, because the trade agreements have not produced jobs, but domestic demand would. And if the plan being put forward by the Canadian bank reformers were adopted by the government, then the economy would start to grow very rapidly. We would reduce unemployment by 50% in 2 years, and there would be the same kind of robust economy that we had from 1939 to 1974. But we have to get them to look at it, and then we have to get them to do it, and we're encouraging people from right across the country to write to the Prime Minister and say, we want you to adopt this plan and to start using the Bank of Canada for the benefit of its shareholders immediately, because that's the only way you're going to be able to solve your problems. It's the only way you're going to be able to keep your promises, because you can't really keep them without the money to do it, and you haven't got the money, and we don't want you to borrow a lot more and put us deeper in debt, so that we have to pay another $1 trillion in interest in the next few years.
We've been speaking with author, political activist, and veteran parliamentarian Paul Hellyer. He spoke to us from Toronto. You can hear Mr. Hellyer's complete speech on the urgent need to reform the financial and banking system in Canada and abroad by visiting the website www.canadianbankreformers.ca. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. This program airs regularly on Winnipeg radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. We would like to thank all our affiliates for their ongoing support of this program. If you wish to provide feedback, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. The Global Research News Hour will be on hiatus during the summer season. Stay tuned for new episodes of the program to appear in September. You can download previous episodes of this program from the website globalresearch.ca. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Talk to you again in the fall.